Today's show is brought to you by Away. For $20 off a suitcase, visit awaytravel.com/GOT and use promo code GOT during checkout. Welcome to the Game of Thrones podcast, the officially unofficial podcast for Game of Thrones on HBO. I'm Jim.
I'm Aaron.
And today we're talking about Season 7, Episode 2, titled Stormborn. You know, when I heard the term Stormborn applied to Dany, I did not think it was an actual literal thing. I thought it was more of a metaphor.
Nope.
But apparently it's an actual thing.
Yeah, she was born during a historically significant storm on Dragonstone.
That Varys remembers.
So, yeah.
Yeah. Hmm. Yeah, that was interesting to learn. What'd you think of this episode?
So I think that the things that I liked about the episode, I liked as much, if not more, on subsequent watches. I really like the controversy that's kind of arisen from Arya's scene with Dameria. Like, it's so hilarious because I was listening to Alan Sepinwall's podcast, and he started from the position that you talked me into on the Instant Podcast, and then fans talked him into thinking what I originally thought.
And yeah, I'm like, man. I can see it both ways.
Yeah, no, it's beautiful how it plays like that. I will say that the parts I didn't like about the show, I've liked less on subsequent watches. Like, it really bugs me how fast and loose they're playing this Euron thing. I don't buy 1,000 ships. Mm-hmm. I don't buy the fact he's a badass. It's literally like Darth Vader showed up an hour into Return of the Jedi.
Yeah.
And like, check me out, kids. I got lightsabers and shit. It's like, it works. The fact that it works at all is bonkers.
Or if like Luke had run off with all of the stormtroopers, and then Darth Vader said, "Well, guess what? I just built an army of new stormtroopers
in
20 minutes."
And there was no clones, and that they could do that.
Right.
It's really like, I hope that's the last of the narrative, broken ground to have the 4x4 over, because otherwise it's going to threaten to collapse under its own weight.
Right. I mean, that's the thing. You know, when we were talking about this at Con of Thrones and kind of before the season, we were talking about all the jetpacking that would have to happen for all these characters. And I think we need to maybe sit back and apply that as well to plot jetpacking.
Yeah.
You strap a jetpack onto the idea that ships can be built, the idea that Euron can find them in the middle of the sea.
How many jetpacks do you strap on before?
Right.
And that, I guess, like, I was chiding people, like, look, you can't get too up your ass about the jetpacking because, reasons, and you're just not going to enjoy the show. But, like, man, how many of these things we have to strap on and just swallow it before the suspension, they don't work to lift our suspension to disbelief anymore.
Right.
It's a minor concern of mine because I feel like, and again, I don't think it's the Dan and David's fault. I don't think they like the hand that they were dealt, and I think they would rather have a much more elegant story to adapt rather than just a bunch of harebrained ideas that George has been kicking around for 20 years. But that's the hand they're dealt, and if this is the last of the stuff and we can just now tell a conventional story without any, because that's why people like Game of Thrones that weren't into fantasy. Like, it felt grounded and real in a way that a lot of stuff like Lord of the Rings just doesn't.
Yeah.
So, and it's inevitable that it's going to get more fantastical as things go, but, like, just some stuff with this Euron, and it's too bad. It's too bad that there couldn't have been more time to kind of flesh his character out and establish things and why they had to, make it a point that Theon and Yara stole, like, the bulk of the best of the ships of the fleet, and then he shows up, just a few months at best later with an armada that looks like it's even better. Like, what the hell? Were the Ironborn just holding back? Euron gets a whip in his hand. He's like, I'm going to show you how to build boats, boys. and like, now they come out with super ships. It's like, what the hell?
Yeah.
That's the other thing. Like, if the Stormtroopers made off with all of Darth Vader's best ships, and he shows up in the Executor.
Uh-huh.
Oh, you didn't know that I had one 11 times? Oh, sorry. Sorry, we had those waiting in the wings. I don't know. I don't want to bitch too much because I'll turn off the fans. Because this was a great episode.
Right, and the rest of the episode, awesome. There were three scenes I thought were really great, which we'll talk about when we get to them. But Why don't we start with the recap?
Here are the highlights coming up this week on Bald Move.
Our coverage of Hot D, Fire and Blood, and the 1980s Shogun miniseries continues. But then on Tuesday, for the first time in 35 years, we asked a question. Who framed Roger Rabbit? Hop aboard the train to Toontown as we revisit this incredible blending of live action and animation to see if it still holds up all this time later.
Then on Wednesday, we get our first look at Blake Crouch's mind-bending sci-fi series, Dark Matter. The first two episodes drop simultaneously on Apple TV+, and we'll have a pair of podcasts quantumly linked ready for you to observe.
You can find these and many other great podcasts by searching for Bald Move Pulp or Bald Move Prestige in your favorite podcast app.
Getting geared up for the 6th annual Summer Badass Fest. And while we're working on a slate of apex badass films to enjoy, we've got an early action-packed announcement to make.
Just like last year, we're kicking off badass season with a live movie watch and podcast recording. We've rented out a theater for connoisseurs of action films and Bald Move fans that just want to have a great time.
Unlike last year, this year's movie is top secret. Hush, hush. No hints. Except, it's incredibly badass. It stars an absolute icon of the genre. We're willing to bet most of you haven't seen it, and it's going to be an incredible viewing experience with a packed house of Bald Movers.
Those of you who came to last year's screening of Total Recall know what a party it was. And those of you who didn't, now's your chance to experience it. Meet me and Jim. Order some custom movie-themed drinks at the theater's full bar. Then watch us record the full podcast for the movie. We reserved a venue over twice the size as last year, but seating is still limited.
It's happening Friday, June 21st at 7 p.m. in our hometown of Cincinnati. Get full details and buy tickets at baldmove.com/live.
Cincinnati's actually a pretty great city to visit, and we've got lots of details for side adventures on our event page as well. The Reds are playing the Boston Red Sox in their fantastic Riverside Stadium. The thrills of Kings Island just minutes away, and I'll be leading a kayak trip down the scenic Little Miami River on Saturday.
Again, get full details and get your tickets now on our Badass Fest 6 page at baldmove.com/live.
Before we get into the main recap section, there's a couple notes I wanted to talk about. First of all, our spoiler policy, because I guess I caused a stir last week when I talked about these production spoilers, and people thought that maybe that we would discuss those as part of our spoiler cast, and that's not the case. We don't consider production spoilers and leaked scripts and things like that as true spoiler materials. The spoiler stuff is mostly lore from the books, still, you know, discussion of prophecies and some other stuff, and some other in-universe speculation. We also talk about the next week ons and season trailers, stuff that we kind of shy away from talking about on the main podcast. But we're not, to our knowledge, going to drop any spoilers. Now, it's a little tough because I myself am not aware of those spoilers, so my wife, who decided to spoil herself, has graciously agreed to go through a first pass on once I get my notes completed and actually delete the stuff that I have in there that might be, someone trying to trick me into reading a spoiler. So, hopefully with that put in place, we won't have this problem going forward. But, I got a lot of people concerned that we were going to talk about show production based spoilers. That's not going to happen. Also, if you're a PlayStation person, a PlayStation Plus member, Game of Thrones Telltale Season 1 is free for Plus members until the end of this month. And I wanted to say that because we actually did a whole playthrough for the club. I think the first episode of that Telltale Season 1 is free for everybody if you want to check that out. I'll make a link to it under show notes. Also want to thank Highway Superstar for providing our 80s TV remix version of the Game of Thrones theme. It's awesome, and he's awesome for letting us use it. You can find his stuff on SoundCloud. By the way, the link to that is in every show notes for Highway Superstar. This week, we got tons of Game of Thrones stuff coming out. We've got an Empire Business podcast for the club members, which is where we talk about behind-the-scenes stuff with Bald Move. This week's is going to feature advertising and advertising in podcasts. We also are going to be checking out Atomic Blonde on Thursday. We'll have a spoiler-free review for everybody and a spoiler-filled review for club members. And I did chat with Shane Bowman about Twin Peaks. That will be coming out probably Thursday afternoon. So a packed week at baldmove.com. And again, go to baldmove.com to catch up on all that stuff. Whew.
We start off with Dany and Varys and Tyrion kind of starting to plan the invasion of Westeros. And Dany interrogates Varys over turning on his former kings. Varys defends himself by saying basically he works for the people, which pleases Dany because that's kind of who she wants to work for as well. I thought this was a great response from Varys. I thought this was actually a good scene for both of them because Dany is doing a smart thing here.
Yeah.
She's testing the motivations of someone who she doesn't consider to be extremely loyal. And I think that's the right thing to do, right? Tyrion has earned his spot with her, but I think Varys has not yet. But, you know, and Tyrion vouching for him is not quite enough.
No. In fact, I understand why they did it for a script reason, but as Tyrion was doing these kind of desperate, panicky pleas for Varys to not get burned to death, I guess, I thought, like, come on, man. Like, you were tested too.
Yeah.
She's going to have to do this because if she just accepts, you know, now that she's in here and as Tyrion said last season, you're in a great game now and it's terrifying. Like, if she just starts trusting people randomly.
Yeah.
I think that's a clear contrast. I think that's a clear contrast between, like, her and Jon to the extent that we're starting now to compare and contrast these and, like, decide, you know, are these guys actually going to team up? Are they going to be able to work well together? So I thought it was fantastic. And, again, a guy like Varys should be able to stand up to the scrutiny and talk his way out of it.
I think he does, yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, his reasons for doing the things he's doing, I think, are you know, noble and good in their own right, but also, like, super on point with what Dany wants.
Right.
So, yeah, good on him, good on her. Everybody's doing the right thing in this scene.
Yeah.
So Melisandre shows up to convince Dany to team up with Jon, and she being Dany, decides to send a message demanding that he bend the knee. This is interesting. So in the message that Jon gets, I don't remember anything about bending the knee.
Right.
Do you think Tyrion maybe take some liberties with the language he uses?
I do. There's some feedback to that point that Jim just served you a big slice of dry pie for.
Taste
but
it.
I
oh, yeah.
Again, wash it down in the
Arbor. Hey, you're lucky this isn't the Purple Wedding.
I think that is significant. The fact that he is the one that wrote the message, the fact that he's kind of parent trapping him. Like telling them both what they want to hear and trusting in their intrinsic goodness. And the fact that they have enough altruism and pragmatism to see that this is the thing that has to happen for the good of the realm.
Yeah.
The thing is like, I just don't know. It always seemed doubtful that we are going to have this, like, oh, Dany's going to get together with Jon and they're going to have a big marriage and it's going to be the literal Song of Ice and Fire and then they're going to go and vanquish the White Walkers and kill Cersei and everything's going to be happily ever after. I don't think we're going to get a grim, like, really dark ending, but George is always described as bittersweet. So both of these guys and gals making it to the finish line seems unlikely to me, and it seems like, narratively, they're hinting a lot more towards Dany being either a little mad queenie or maybe just not being able to make it to the end. But that could be subversion too. I mean,
it could be, yeah.
Do you find yourself still just really afraid, especially in 90's last two seasons, that anyone can die at any time?
Yeah, I think that's definitely on the table.
Like even when Nymeria is reaching out to, or when Arya is reaching out to Nymeria, I was like, are they just going to have this wolf maul Arya for some point?
Right.
like, maybe not kill her, but whip her arm off or scarf her face real bad so she's really knows. Like, and the thing is, like, I didn't think it would happen, but the danger is there in a way that I don't think has ever been for any other show.
Yeah.
That anyone could die at any time. And it doesn't even have to have a point to it. It could just be like, well, yep, you forgot that this world's dangerous. Uh-huh. So killed someone you loved. that adds a lot, nice little spice about any scene you're watching.
Yeah, for sure. It made a lot of sense for Melisandre to show up here. I think that's one of the places we assumed she could be going. They're kind of connecting the dots between the Red Priestess and Marine that they had recruited and now Melisandre here in Westeros. I think that's kind of what they knew they were going for when they did that.
Yeah.
And it felt maybe a little weird and out of place. Was it last season or the season before when they recruited the Red Priestess?
Oh, it seemed like that was something that was in motion. Like Tyrion, the season before last, Tyrion saw when he was like on his way to the Queen that this was really doing a number on the hearts and minds of the local folk.
Yeah.
And then I think he was the one that said, you know, we should kind of lean on these when Dany was gone. And they're like looking for something to hold the city together.
Yep.
Which was interesting because it's essentially a slightly smarter version of what Cersei did with the Faith Militant. And it didn't blow up in his face.
Right.
Melisandre, was she wearing a backpack or was there some sort of vaginal rocketry?
Maybe.
If so, how many stages? Was it a bi-propellant system?
It's maybe she can just
shoot shadow babies out at rapid speed and has equal and opposite reaction.
I mean, she might literally be able to teleport.
Yeah, I mean,
I don't know what's possible with Melisandre.
When it comes to, like, faceless men magic, Melisandre, the Lord of the Lights, what Bran can do, like, it's uncomfortably open-ended.
Yeah, for the most part. It hadn't really crossed my mind that maybe I just assumed, like, plot shortcuts here.
Sure. I was just making a joke about vaginal rocketry. I just have this like the serene face Melisandre with like just a gout of flame shooting out of her dress streaking across the sky. Just that makes me that tickles me.
So they make a point here to say that this prophecy that they're talking about with the prince who was promised is not necessarily a prince. It's also it could be translated as a princess.
One more a book spoiler they pride out from us.
They're taking away all the things
yeah.
that book spoiler people can hold over the show watchers' heads.
Yeah, because that's been something that's long bandied about this idea that Valyrian with such that puts dragons on these pedestals and the fact that dragons are at least asexual if not hermaphrodites. Mm-hmm. Their gender designators in their language are more fluid to reflect the supremacy of dragons. It also explains like some more of their culture, the fact that women were accepted as conquerors in Targaryen culture and presumably Valyrian more so than you'd ever see in Westeros.
Mm-hmm.
Lady Mormont and aside.
This felt like to me a writer doing something for writer fan service.
Yeah,
like I'm the author of a book. Wouldn't it be cool if we did like a translational mistake sort of thing?
Sure,
as a major plot point. And I mean that's fine. You know, as a show watcher, I'm like, oh, maybe that's a little too clever for me. But
yeah, I guess the guy that made the stink about it being the prince that was promised and how grammatically incorrect. He sent an email this morning and I didn't have a chance to fact check him, but claimed that it was now the prince who was promised, and they introduced this translation error, and he just like as a linguist it made him happy. So yeah, I think you're onto something there.
Yeah, I'm sure he was jumping up and down, loving it. Let's move on to Jon and Sansa discussing the letter from Dany and Tyrion. I guess the letter's from Tyrion, but via Tyrion from Dany.
Right.
Jon is torn on whether to accept their invitation, and he kind of passes it around to Sansa and to Davos. They both give their opinion on it. Sansa kind of stands up for Tyrion a little bit, but says, you know, he's still a Lannister.
It's just too risky to go and meet with her directly. Although Davos is like, could use those dragons.
Yeah. Could use that dragon glass. They don't know about that yet. this comes in before Sam's letter. But
I'm talking about dragons. He was talking about the actual, not dragon glass, but like we could use the dragons because whites, you know, you said that the whites have weakness to fire. Like he's essentially, it's good to see Davos catching up to like where we were at three seasons ago just watching the show.
And they leave this scene open-ended, so you don't know what Jon's decision is, and apparently neither do Sansa or Davos, because they're both blindsided later by the decision. This is the moment where Jon should have said, yes, it's risky to you two. To Sansa and Davos should have said, it's risky, but I'm doing it.
Right.
So, like, maybe present a united front when I go to tell the other lords of the houses.
Yeah.
But he doesn't, and so it becomes a thing later.
I do think that I really like the establishing shot of Winterfell. So you see, like, these grizzled vets are training the young kids on how to shoot a bow, and kind of gives you the stakes that, like, you know, it's easy to talk about mobilization of an entire civilization, but when you see, like, kids being trained for war, it really sells the stakes. Like, this is all or nothing. Like, you know, our compunctions about using women and children, you know. If we hold to that, we're going to lose the war. So I thought that was really cool in light of the last episode.
Mm-hmm. Then we go over to Cersei addressing some of the heads of houses, including Randall Tarly, to try to recruit them into the war to come. Randall thinks the dragons are a problem, but Qyburn says, hey, we're working on a solution. Jaime then afterward goes and has his own conversation with Randall and asks him to join them in the war. He says, I swore an oath to the Tyrells and he won't break it. But Jaime reminds him that he also swore an oath to the crown, and he appeals to his xenophobia in order to change his mind. That's interesting. Because I think Randall Tarly is the kind of guy who goes for that sort of argument.
No, totally. And I don't think he has... I mean, what Cersei's saying is half-truths and bullshit, and as you said, appeals to the xenophobia. Mm-hmm. But she's not entirely, I mean, that's the reason these half-truths are so dangerous, is because, you know, this is the Mad Queen's daughter. She did do a lot of probably senseless and counterproductive bloodshed when she was feeling a little bit more dragony over in Meereen. And she did, like, this for these nobles and these lords to hear that she just, on a whim, crucified hundreds of their kind, like, that's horrible. That shouldn't be able to happen to them. So I thought it was pretty effective. And also the fact that, you know, Tarly can remember the fact, you know, back when the Mad King was ruling and all the bad things that happened. And the fact that, you know, Dothraki, that you know, and that's the thing, like, you know, Dothraki culture does seem pretty asshole centric. Mm-hmm. I wouldn't want Dothraki. I mean, I try not to be xenophobic or racist. But I would hate for the Dothraki to camp in my neighborhood. Mm-hmm. Like, they literally just take and pillage and rape whatever. And that's not, like, a stereotype. That is, like, their culture.
Their culture, right.
Yeah. So, you know, it's there's a lot of fascinating questions about, you know, once Dany accomplishes what she's going to do, how is she going to integrate these into her new Westeros? Mm-hmm. And that's something, I mean, these are all, if you haven't noticed, these are all questions that we struggle with in modern times as well. Mm-hmm. How do you defeat half-truths and lies? How do you defeat propaganda? How do you defeat, you know, racism, xenophobia, when there is, like, some concern about cultures coming together and which culture will get ascendancy and which values have supremacy? It's super interesting and satisfying to watch all this kind of in a fantasy setting, because it allows people to, I think about it in a way that's, like, not so, like, up in your face.
Right, a more abstract way.
Exactly.
Yeah, so... One of the funniest things in here, Dickon Tarly, who apparently Jaime didn't remember his name, but I don't see how, because it's a hilarious name.
But it's also, he just makes him for Rickard, which I'm like, so to me, that's like Richard and Dick. Mm-hmm. So if you go up and be like, Richard, right? And the guy's like, no, asshole, it's actually Dick. Uh-huh. Like,
I
guess, yeah, you're right. I'm the asshole. I don't know, maybe it doesn't work that way, but it seems to me like it's kind of like an English allusion to these different nicknames. So I thought that was another kind of funny layer on that, too.
And just how dismissive he is of the kid. He's like, whatever. I'm here to talk to your dad.
Right.
Then we go over to Sam.
I thought that was a little... I mean, I appreciate the humor, but also Jaime had... he knew he was going to have a tough time convincing Randall here, and I don't know... That felt like old Jamie a little bit, and it didn't feel like it's in keeping with his more mature. I mean, that's something you can do when you're smacking around Lord Walder Frey, but you know, Randall Tarley is probably the most important person they need to get on their side. Do you really want to take digs at his son, who he must think highly of?
Yeah, he kind of has to think highly of,
right?
Because like he doesn't think highly of Sam.
Right. But this guy, you know, he's tall and he's handsome. Presumably he knows how to hold a sword. Like, you know, maybe not go after his shining jewel of his loins. Maybe, Jamie. I don't know.
Yeah, well, it didn't seem to affect the conversation at all. Then we go to Sam and the Archmaester. What's his name?
I don't think we've gotten one yet.
No?
There's okay. Speculation on who he might be from the books, but they have so far not given us his last name.
Okay. They're examining Jorah. The maester says he's got about 6 months before he goes insane from the grayscale. Sam tries to tell him there might be a cure, but the maester shuts him down and says he's going to ship Jorah off to Valeria, but he's going to give him a day because he's an anointed knight. Good thing for Jorah because he needs a little bit of time here. Jorah looks real bad.
Yeah.
Jorah's looking the worst I've seen outside of Valeria, a grayscale victim looking.
It's pretty bad. And he's got 6 months till he essentially loses his mind.
Yeah, it looks like his skin is like the surface of slowly drying lava.
Yeah.
It's like really gross.
Mm-hmm.
And then we go over to Qyburn, unless you want to talk more about Sam.
Nope.
Qyburn's taking Cersei down to the catacombs, and he shows her the new weapon he's developed to use against the dragons. This was a really cool scene. Mm-hmm. I liked seeing all the dragon bones there under King's Landing, and especially the giant dragon whose name I don't remember.
Balerion the Dread.
Balerion. Yeah, that skull was really cool.
I've often wondered, because, like, obviously you shouldn't destroy dragon skulls just because you hate the Targaryens, because the historical value of such artifact. But I've always wondered why Robert was content to strike them down to the dungeons and not just, like, grind them to dust to be like, there you fucking Targaryens, what do you think of that?
Yeah.
But I felt like Cersei's one-off thing about, oh, he used to bring his whores down here to impress, like, yeah, look at these guys, I conquered them all. Now, you know, let's climb into the mouth of Balerion and you know, generate some heat, generate some dragon fire. I thought that was a nice character moment from Beyond the Grave, because I totally buy him going down there with a couple flagons of wine and a couple women and having a good time.
Yeah. The other cool thing about this scene is the ballista. I think it's going to be obviously this is not the only one. Mm-hmm. I assume they're.
You're on can build 1,000 ships in 2 weeks, but it took all of the finest artillators, which I've never even heard that word, and blacksmiths, you know, 6 months to make this one crossbow, and that's it. No more.
Yeah, no more. No, presumably they're installing these all along the walls.
It's like German stock clockwork mechanisms. They have to hand file the gears by hand. You just got the one shot.
It didn't look incredibly complex or anything.
No, I feel like that there's,
scaled up crossbow. Come on.
When I saw that scene, my first thought is, wow, for sure one of Dany's dragons are going to die. Mm-hmm. I don't think it's going to massacre them all, but I can't see... Because you're right, this looks like something that they could probably have 100 on the walls of the Red Keep, and they could just send a hail of these things at the dragons, and it's going to wound or kill at least one, if not more.
Definitely one, I think, yeah.
And that's like, you know, then like, you know, what is Dany going to do then? Like, if you're looking for a reason for her to go full on Mad Queen, the death of one of her children might have that go. Like, that might have her be the Queen of the Ashes. And it's also starting to tie in other things, like the fact when she went through her vision quest in the House of the Undying in season 2, like, she saw... she saw the throne room, what some people thought of like snow falling, but also a lot of people at the time thought it was ash, like it had been burnt to a crisp.
Yep.
Starting to think that, I don't know, maybe the evil Mad Queen Daenerys might be something to come that comes of this. Or maybe that's just a future vision that she could subvert. Who knows?
Yeah, I mean, when you look at the next scene and kind of the prompting she's getting from various forces here, I could definitely see it. I can see it. Let's get to that scene. Dany, Tyrion, Varys, Alaria, Yara, and Elena are discussing how they're going to take Westeros. Tyrion's plan is to use the domestic troops to lay siege to King's Landing and the foreign troops to take Casterly Rock. He's doing this essentially for political reasons. Danny and Elena discuss...
It makes him look so smart.
It does. Yeah, he always looks smart.
Mm-hmm.
Danny and Elena discuss the plan privately afterward, and Elena tells Danny she should not listen to Tyrion. Instead, she should be a dragon.
Yeah, I
oh boy.
Don't know. Like, this seems like, again, more things are pointing towards maybe Danny flying off half-cocked because...
Yeah.
Or I guess no-cocked if you're just not going to listen to clever men. You know, I'm all for female empowerment as much as possible, but like it seems like Olenna is just offering like almost misandry, like just you know, men are stupid and dumb, and I've lived a long time because I've never been on a battlefield.
Well,
and you know what I'm saying, like it's like
sure, I get you. I think what is happening here,
the reason you've outlived all the clever men is just because you're even smarter than them. That mm-hmm. that I don't know. Maybe it's true. I just thought it was not a great argument.
So a couple of things could be happening here. One for sure. One, Elena just wants revenge. Like her family line has been snuffed out. She wants revenge before she dies on Cersei.
And she has no future, right. Which should make Danny be wary of what she's saying because, you know, if all she needs is Cersei to die before she shuffles off into the grave, well, that doesn't really line up with your not wanting to be Queen of the Ashes theory.
Right. Now, I don't know if this is also happening, but this could be a test. In the same way that Danny is, like, testing Varys to try and understand his motivations, she could be testing Danny's motivations by trying to encourage her in the wrong direction and to ignore her advisors.
Yeah.
I think that's a risky move because if she fails the test, you've got a real problem. Depending on how aligned she is with, like, Randall Tarly. And, you know, I don't know what kind of forces she could muster on her own if Danny were to, you know, lose the will of the people, I guess.
Right. Well,
but I don't think she's playing that long of a game anymore. I really think it's just about revenge.
And the other thing that sucks to be Tyrion is that I think his plan is very clever and it was the thing to do. Unfortunately, it doesn't seem like it's going to survive entirely on first contact with the enemy.
Yeah, definitely.
Because the Dorne are not going to be able to reinforce the Tyrells. The Tyrell army looks like it's going to be split. I mean, that's what they want us to believe anyway.
Right.
So how are they actually going to lay siege to King's Landing? Is Tyrion going to have enough ships left to ferry the Unsullied over to Casterly Rock? Like, these are all questions that are worth asking. And now, you know, a lot of people are like, you know, Dan, you're so stupid. You land on this island with your fleet and all your army is stuck here. And now half your fleet or more is gone. How are you going to get these Dothraki and Unsullied around? And that's a good question.
Yeah.
That's an excellent question. So all these things are going to really... I'm wondering if Tyrion's going to lose a little bit of power at court because clearly he's the driving force behind this kinder, gentler takeover of Westeros, and it's kind of going to at least partially blow up in his face.
Yeah, which might prompt Dany to do some things that Tyrion doesn't want her to do and that maybe Elena does.
Right.
Yeah, that's a real shame because I'm looking forward to seeing a siege. We haven't seen one of those yet, and I would like to.
Right.
The one at River Run was not much of a siege. Well, it lasted very, very little time.
Right. I mean, King's Landing was under siege for the majority of season two.
Yeah.
And they showed, I mean, they didn't have the budget back then, but they showed through the suffering of the people and the starvation and the deprivation that... what was going on, the preparations, like the big trebuchets,
right,
and all that.
The
so like
necklace full of poison.
We have seen it, but like now
but
we
not
haven't
really
seen
it.
Yeah,
seen
we
it.
Haven't seen a full glory siege.
Yeah,
on Game of Thrones.
That was exciting to me. The other thing we learn in this scene is Ellaria, you know, is de facto leader of Dorne at this
yes.
point. She controls all the armies.
Yeah.
I don't know how that happens politically. I guess might makes right sort of thing. You kill the person in charge. You're
right.
Now the Klingon, the captain of the ship.
Yeah, I doubt it goes down that way in the books. There's very little precedent for, you know, even high-minded Dorne that doesn't matter, you know, doesn't care about bastards that much. I don't know how cool they would be with, you know, a bastard leading a revolution of bastards to depose the rightful rulers of the realm.
Mm-hmm.
That's clearly what they've done in the show, and
it's surprising to me that there's no Inquisition of Ellaria as well. Like, as much as you want to question Varys' loyalty, I think you should also question Ilaria's loyalty.
Yeah.
She doesn't stick it to Ilaria the same way she does to Varys.
That's true. You killed your rightful lord, and, you know, because things didn't go your way. Although I will say that Dorne has probably had enough of Lannister shit.
Uh-huh.
The fact that, you know, they already saw the betrayal of Princess Elia as a slight. So maybe the country, and then the fact that Oberon got killed and that miscarriage of justice, like, it maybe the whole country's mood shifted away from the relatively weak Doran to the strong Sand Snake alliance.
Yeah, could be. The other thing, correct me if I'm wrong, Kevin is at Casterly Rock right now, isn't he?
I wish you'd asked me that, because I don't know, because it's one of the things where I think the book and the show have diverged.
Okay.
But Kevin's dead. Kevin was absolutely, because I remember looking this up in the preseason, he died in the wildfire conflagration.
He did? I don't remember seeing him there.
Yeah. Because I watched that last episode, and I could be wrong. I'm going to make a stand and say I think that he's dead in the series now.
Who the hell is at Casterly Rock then?
Damn,
anybody?
Fine question. No, they just left it empty. That's what they do with castles.
It's like Dragonstone, they winter Casterly Rock.
Yeah, they throw some antifreeze down the storm cellars so nothing freezes over in winter, and they just take off.
Yeah.
That's smart. Funny because, like, if Casterly Rock is, like, lightly garrisoned, because the Eyrie and the Vale... They actually do that in winter. They abandon the castle because it's just unlivable in the winter.
Huh.
And they go down to the lowlands. So you could potentially have three, four, if you count Harrenhal, great castles that are just, like, open for bid. The Dreadfort?
Uh-huh.
There's more castles for grabs than...
Twins.
It's the real estate bubble has just burst in Westeros. Right. It's a buyer's market right now.
Sure is. All right, then we go over to one of my favorite scenes of the episode after I got over the questions I had about the scene.
Yeah.
Missandei comes to say goodbye to Grey Worm, and he tells her that she's his quote-unquote weakness, which is essentially, like, he fears losing her. And then he does what he can to please her with what he's got.
Wasn't that a Cool J song? Sweetness is my weakness?
I don't know.
I feel like that was like a...
That sounds like something he'd write.
Uh-huh.
I really, really like... this scene. I think Missandei and Grey Worm, both of those actors do an incredible job with very little dialogue. You know, aside from Grey Worm's, like, monologue there about fear, once they come together, it's like there's a lot of unspoken stuff there that I think is really good. Also, you get to see Missandei naked, which is always pleasurable.
Yeah,
for me.
she's spectacular. I was disappointed.
I wanted to see
what Grey Worm was looking like down there.
Yeah, I'm not sure why they don't show it.
It's purely he's not a real person, so I there's no one to make uncomfortable with this curiosity and gaze. But it's just pure unvarnished curiosity of, like, how are they going to depict that?
I mean, same with Varys, you know. I mean, really, either of them could open the robe, and
what's that look like?
Like, curiosity,
like,
man.
Buffalo Bill, Buffalo Bill style tuck job with a little bit of latex scars.
Probably,
that's how they go down.
That's my guess.
But no, I thought it was good, and also. You know, since I'm always shitting my pants about my favorite characters dying, and I really like Grey Worm, and I really like Missandei, Grey Worm's totally dead now, right?
Now that he's...
Like, the fact that it's like Samson telling Delilah, hey, if you cut my hair, I'm fucked. I've identified, or Superman telling Lex Luthor, hey, you know, I can handle about anything, that kryptonite stuff, like... I'm revealing the fact that I have a weakness, and I'm fearful for the first time going into battle.
Yeah.
So if he doesn't die, it's actually a subversion of the foreshadowing.
Mm-hmm.
But boy, it feels like, you know, giving him this moment that's been brewing for seasons and seasons, and the fact that, you know, because my feedback was pretty mixed between defenses of this storyline, exasperation that with only 11 episodes to go, we've got these guys having sex with. Which hasn't been a huge payoff to a main storyline.
It's the only fucking thing they've got in the storyline. Give it to them.
Yeah.
Like, Missandei's not going to get any other glory storyline.
Exactly.
Grey Worm's not going to get to sit on the throne in the end.
They have these are slaves that have had no agency on their lives, and they've developed this warm relationship. And I also think that they did with showing the... Unsullied being assassinated, laying with a woman, not for any sexual pleasure, but just for, you know, the closeness of physical contact, which these men have been denied their whole lives.
Right. Yeah.
Like, and as you say, his monologue, he talks about just how fucking brutal this all is. They've never known anything that's gentle and yielding and warm and loving. So it makes perfect sense that they would gravitate towards each other.
Yeah, and Grey Worm here is a stand-in for all of the Unsullied.
Yes.
And those two together are a stand-in for all of the slaves that were freed.
And this shows shows why they're so insanely loyal to Dany, because they, you know, the undercurrent of this is like, without her, none of this would have been possible. And these are things that they're thinking for and feeling for the very first time.
And this is the perfect time to do it, when they're having conversations about whether or not Dany's going to be the queen of the ashes, or whether she's going to do the right thing by the people. This is why it's important. These are the people she's freed. These are the people she's fighting for. It's super important in this scene. And I think all of that comes through. They did a really good job with it.
Yeah.
So Sam follows the maester around as he collects books for his research. And he advises him on how to write stories. I would argue that he doesn't advise him very well. Or at least with the titles. He's not great with titles. He tries to suggest a cure for Jorah that he read in a book. And the maester says, oh, yeah, I've read that book too. And you know how the author died? Grayscale. Later that night, Sam tries it anyway. He goes to Jorah and he tries to cure him in a truly horrific scene.
It's bad.
It's as bad as the one last episode.
It's too bad all the Boltons are dead, because
they would love
they'd peel him like a potato and it'd be all over. But you see why it's dangerous, because like Jorah was touched by one of these guys and he gets grayscale. Sam, like, granted, he's wearing a heavy apron and gloves.
Yeah, but...
But... You know, those pus pockets looked unstable that he's poking lances into.
Yeah. Yeah, you could
get
imagine
some of that in your
eyeball spray.
Or some spray, or just like you scratch your nose in an inopportune time.
Yeah.
You got to worry about like little Sam and his
right.
I've completely spaced on his
Gilly.
Gilly, thank you. But then again, I guess if he masters the cure, then if you get a little you get a little bit of grayscale, no problem. The problem is with Jorah is that it's everywhere.
It is, yeah.
So it's going to be a long man. The sounds Jorah was making,
yeah,
it's like a goat being butchered and drowned at the same time. It was,
and some of those shots, like the overhead, where they show his face in focus and the cutting knot.
Yeah.
Yeah, it was really great. And then Sam like kind of gets halfway through it, looks up at him, and then just starts sawing away.
Yeah, like it's maybe this is like the rip a Band-Aid off approach. And also the fact that he's removed maybe like a wallet-sized portion, and he's still got the delicate area around the nipple. And
All the areas.
Ugh. Yeah, armpit. Armpit's the trickiest.
It does look like Jorah was ready to off himself, given the text of that letter that he's writing. To Dany, it was essentially
like,
I failed.
Did you see a transcript of that? Yeah.
I did, yeah. Uh-huh. Basically, I failed. I came here thinking the maesters could help me with all their arts. They can't. You know, I failed. I've always loved you. I wanted to live to see what you were building.
If there's a life after this one, then it kind of trailed off. But yeah, I thought he was going to do the honor killing.
And when he looks over at his sword, they show it. He's ready to kill himself when Sam comes in.
Now, so we had a lot of discussions last week about the theory that Sam might be very much like Samwise from The Lord of the Rings, where it turns out that he's actually one of the author of the tales that you're reading right now. Did you think that there was a little joke here about like the Archmaester emphasizing you have to have research and a bit of style, and Sam criticizes his boring title and the fact that we are partaking of an entertainment that's known as A Song of Ice and Fire?
Very poetic.
That's very poetic.
Yeah.
I think that they're at least hinting towards that.
Could be. Could be. I'll say I don't think I'll be like disappointed in the ending if they go that route.
Right.
I do think it can be done poorly. It's pretty easy to do that poorly.
Yeah, because you're treading on dangerous waters. Number one, you're doing a naked allusion to already established respected work. Sam's already a bit of a Mary Sue character for George Martin himself. He's this chubby, nerdy guy that's more interested in wizards than he is in warriors. And but he's also the slayer and he gets the woman. And, you know, there's a little bit like I think George has to be careful that he doesn't
doesn't go too that far down the Mary Sue route here. Or I guess now it's the double D's. For forget George for a moment. It's Dan and David have to worry about how much of they want to indulge in that.
Who would they be in the story?
The double D's?
That's a good Mary question. Sue for the double D's?
I don't know. They're too that's a good question. That's a damn fine question.
Maybe we can think on it a week. Come
all right.
Back with it.
All right.
So we go over to Arya visiting Hot Pie on her way to King's Landing. He catches her up on the happenings at Winterfell, and she decides she's going to head north instead of south, which I was happy to see. I was trying to think of like the things she knows happened in Winterfell or in Westeros, and kind of everything she saw in the play is probably as recent as she is. Mm-hmm. Like that play over in
Essos
in. Trying to think Bravos. Of the city. Bravos, yes. I think that's as up-to-date as she was before this conversation.
Yeah.
So I'm wondering, Hot Pie never mentions anything about Sansa being there.
Uh-huh.
So I'm wondering if she's going to be surprised by that.
Right.
And if she ever makes it there.
This might be some more dry pie we're handing out in the feedback, but I know people are mentioning, or maybe someone asked me why... Does Sansa know about Arya, and if so, why she hasn't told Jon? And I do think they had that conversation because Brienne and Arya and Sansa were talking, and she mentioned in fact that Arya is running around dressed as a little boy, and Sansa's like, "Yeah, that sounds about right. That sounds like my sister."
Yep.
But I don't think there's any indication that she's told Jon that. On the other hand, there was kind of like we caught the tail end of their catching up talk last season. Like, you know, they're like, oh, it's good to see you. We got to trust each other.
We did.
Who knows what they told each other? And I don't feel like it would be a cheat for or maybe it's just because I'm willing to give him a lot of leeway because I really want this to happen. But like I don't care if Arya shows up and Jon acts surprised or even say like if Arya shows up at Winterfell, I'm prepared to overlook a lot of weird like conversations that probably shouldn't happen and didn't.
Oh, I'm super excited for that.
Because also
possibility.
Also just like it's just like after all their talk of trusting each other and keeping each other in the loop and not holding secrets, they still just don't seem like they're communicating that well.
No,
so
it's ridiculous.
This would be like, oh sorry for Ari being alive slipped my mind, John.
Yep. Maybe we should head over to that scene.
One other thing is like I started noticing on my subsequent watches that there is an unusual amount of talk about surviving.
Okay.
Like, you know, Varys making a stand that I'm a survivor and Ari and Hot Pie saying that him and Arya are the same because they're both survivors. That's scary. That's a lot of people defiantly talking about how they're survivors and about to go to major war. So that's
I think
all
Hot
I
Pie
say.
Gets it before the end of the show.
I don't know. I mean, everyone needs pies and they like them hot. So he might be able to find a way to navigate through the dangerous waters.
Yeah,
I'm
I think
more
that's
worried
the
about
last, probably the last we've seen of Hot Pie. Yeah.
I mean, I thought the last time we saw a Hot Pie was the last you'd see a Hot Pie. So
yeah, but now there's significantly less time left in the show. Like, you complain
about
the Sandy Grey Worm scene. Come on, Hot Pie scene?
There's always bananas in the Hot Pie stand, is all I'm saying. You can't ever count them out.
Yeah, I guess they're going to be diehard fans. So we go over to John, who gets a message from Sam about the Dragonglass under Dragonstone. And he then goes and addresses the heads of the Northern Houses.
Which, by the
says,
way, we talked about the transition of the you know, the surgery scene going into the Hot Pies, but I thought it was a nice transition for Arya riding north as Jon that panned down and Jon is you know, pouring over the map of roughly where Arya was riding from. I thought that was a nice little transition too.
Yeah, that's cool. They did a pretty neat one with Sam reaching for a book as well, or the Maester reaching for a book. Thought that was kind of funny. But yeah, John then goes and addresses the houses of the heads of the Northern Houses and says he also got an invitation from Dany to go to Dragonstone. He's sort of convinced by the idea of getting access to the Dragonglass and decides he's going to accept the invitation. Everyone here stands up and says, "You're a fool.
Right.
This is a terrible idea." Sansa, Lady Mormont, everybody. And he says he's going to do it anyway, and he leaves Sansa in charge of the North while he's gone.
"I will never stop fighting for it, no matter the odds." Like,
no matter the Hods, what is a Hod? Hey, I'm not from the North. What's a Hod? I don't know. Why is he wanting the mat of the Hod? I don't get it. He's like, I just felt like, is that even a I mean, I'm speaking completely out of ignorance, but is that even a recognizable dialect of English? Like, I just feel like,
I don't know. I'm not noticing it as crazily as you are. Like,
really?
He's excited, but I didn't know.
No, the odds. It's yeah. I don't know. I thought I was laughing out loud when he got to the no matter the odds part.
Nice. But I don't know. I think he's got a pretty good excuse here to do what he's doing. You know, even if he himself doesn't trust Dany or Tyrion fully, they need what they've got. Mm-hmm. John needs what Danny's got, which is dragons and dragon glass. Mm-hmm. It's the only way they can fight what's coming.
And manpower.
Yeah, yeah. Having more troops is certainly important.
Although, it's funny because they don't mention what to do with the Dothraki. Mm-hmm. And I've got in my mind like this odd couple situation of like, you know, all the wildlings are garrisoning these castles along the wall, and they send also the Dothraki there. Mm-hmm. And like, you know, you got these heavy fur coats against the guys with the loincloths, and they're just kind of like looking each other skeptical. I don't think the Dothraki are prepared to fight in winter.
No, definitely not. And I don't know how you appropriately clothe that many troops.
Mm-hmm.
When you don't really have anything.
Like, right.
Dany lands in Dragonstone. There's not a cache of
clothing
there.
Is there enough fur in the North that you can lay hands on?
Not, well, maybe get Euron in here. Maybe uh-huh. He's as good at gathering furs as he is at building ships.
It'd be funny if there's like an animated series based on the Game of Thrones where it's like all the forest animals like just running like they treat men like the White Walkers. They just come and take our skins. Raptum says it's in there. They're just trying to get south as fast as they can. Get to where it's warm and they don't need our skins.
Yep. There's also, so I've kind of talked about, you know, how they should have sat down and discussed this.
Uh-huh.
Specifically like Jon's decision here. He should have discussed it with Sansa, and he can't be pissed at Sansa.
Like he got this note from Sam, immediately called a council.
Right.
Like, it's so clear that he did not run this by Jorah or Sansa, and it's just like, why?
Yeah, he got their opinion on Tyrion, but he didn't say, this is what I plan to do.
Well, not only that, but he got new information. He got this thing about the dragon glass and
didn't
even like mention it. So, there seemed to be a fair amount of people taking me to task, being like, look, why are you sweating this? It's, you know, it was more dramatic. And I don't know. I just feel like both of these characters have made many statements about needing to trust each other and keep each other informed. And mm-hmm. Jon was the one that had, you know, the last time to kind of browbeat Sansa over it. And he's doing the same thing to her. So it's like, to me, if that's intentional, like, yes, it's dramatic, but also it's telling me something about Jon's leadership style that I'm judging negatively.
Yeah.
And if it's purely for drama, then that's an unintended consequence in a narrative that shouldn't be there.
Yeah, kind of the communication here between Jon and Sansa is a clusterfuck because
yes,
it starts off with Sansa saying not a damn thing right before they're about to go potentially get killed
right.
in the Battle of the Bastards
right.
About you know, having the Lord of the Vale behind them,
yeah.
like having Robin behind them, having Littlefinger there to come in and save the day. They could have held off for an hour, for 2 hours, and waited for Littlefinger to get there, and then it's no contest. But yeah. instead, she kept her mouth shut. She didn't say anything, and Jon ran off and almost got killed.
Right. And many, many guys died that day that probably didn't need to.
And now Jon seems to be doing exactly the same thing to
I know,
her. And
I
it's,
know.
It's ridiculous. I don't know if Jon's just petty. Or
that's
what
I'm
it
saying.
Is.
Like, it would be disappointing to me if this is just them going for the drama, not thinking things through. But like, you never with this show, it's in hindsight whether like, oh, is this an intentional like showing something about Jon and Sansa's leadership style that's maybe fatal, or it's a complicated, or is this just, oh, won't it be awesome to see them get in a fight, and then just when you think things aren't out, Jon and trust her with the North.
Right.
And then Brienne's over there like,
yeah, I mean, it's a moment. It's for sure it's a moment. But like,
at what cost?
At
what cost to the characters and what we think about them?
Also, during that moment, I couldn't help but think, oh, how fucking self-serving Sansa. Oh, you've got a huge problem with him going off until he hands you the North and then you keep your mouth shut. Oh, yeah. No, great idea. See you, Jon.
Mm-hmm,
nice.
Mm-hmm.
Bye. don't want the gate hit
you. Well, it did address... I thought it made sense that it shut her up, because number one...
It's shocking.
Yeah, it's shocking that she's now going to have the power while he's gone, and that's a sign of... even though that you could argue that this, you know, not informing her was a breach of trust, this is like an immediate reversal of breach of trust.
Yeah.
And it's got Littlefinger like kind of stirring, like, oh, there's another rung of chaos I might be able to climb. And like, I like Brienne's kind of smug, like, yeah, this is going to be all the single ladies in charge now. it's a good scene. It's just, I walk away thinking that this is going to be a problem if Jon can't get this internal communications thing nailed down.
So, speaking of Littlefinger, the next scene is him following Jon to the crypts to tell him that he loved Catelyn, and now he loves Sansa, and also, do you have any other relatives I could get with?
Like, I hear you have an even younger sister, right? An even more inappropriate target for my affections.
And Jon chokes him. He says, don't even think about touching Sansa, or I'll kill you personally.
Yeah.
And then he leaves Winterfell.
Yeah, there's a lot to... So... I don't understand what Littlefinger thought he was accomplishing here.
Right.
Like, if it almost seems like if this was some sort of bug up Jon's bonnet that made him leave Winterfell so he could put the moves on Sansa or start manipulating her again. But Jon had already made his mind up.
Mm-hmm.
And I felt like, you know, reminding of all Littlefinger trying to go in and remind him, like, hey, I brought your father's bones, didn't have to. Hey, I loved your mother. That was cool. Also, I know that she was kind of a bitch to you. Also, I saved your ass, and also I love Sansa. Like, it seemed uncharacteristically misstep by. I don't know. He's going to go show Sansa's bruised neck and be like, look what your brooding fucking brother did to me. He's a madman. Like, I don't get his play here.
No, it felt very desperate. Like, this is the last chance I'm going to get to speak with Jon. I need to get some hooks in. And
but his hooks were shitty.
His hooks were, just the wimpiest of all
hooks.
He's
hunting for bass, and he's got stink bait on his hooks. Like, he's trying for bass. He's going for catfish. What the hell?
I thought maybe he was trying to make a play here to rule alongside Sansa with Jon's permission. I don't know what his deal is, but it didn't work, obviously. It was shut down immediately with the choke slam.
Right.
Just like Ned choked him. We talked about that kind of in the instant take.
And just like, you know, Ned's brother also beat him down for trying to make moves on Kat in the original. Yeah. Oh, yeah, that's right. Three Stark men have beat the shit out of him for stepping to their women now.
Now that you say it, did Ned choke him?
Yeah, he's like when he thought he said, "Oh, I'll take you to your wife," and he takes him to the whorehouse, and Ned grabs him. He's like, "Oh, you think you're a clever man, don't you?"
Right.
So,
yeah, bad track record with the
Starks. Should just have like a Stark sized hand tattooed on his throat, you know?
Yeah, I think he backed the wrong horse. He should have backed the Boltons, honestly.
Because that would have kept him.
Chance with them.
I think you're right. That would have kept him in good graces with. Maybe his weakness is Sansa.
Yeah.
Like, he's like, I've always been skeptical that, like, even if he loves Sansa, she's still second place next to his ambitions.
Right.
Which explains why he threw her to the Boltons and all that, because I don't buy that. Oh, I didn't know anything about Ramsay. Uh-huh. I know everything that happens in this fucking kingdom, but I didn't know that one of the most notorious butchers in the North was a notorious butcher. Uh-huh. I don't know. I can't figure him out. I don't understand his angle. Like, at the end, like, Sansa and Jon share, like, a melancholy goodbye, which I was trying to read a lot into, but, like, well, Jon's going off to something, like, if Sansa really loves him, Jon's going off someplace dangerous that she thinks he's got, like, you know, good odds of being betrayed, that would explain the look. Jon thinks this as well. Mm-hmm. He's also worried about leaving his sister behind. Like, there's plenty... I think I saw online people were just jumping at, like, oh, look at all the shifty looks Sansa's giving to Jon. And I feel like there's a lot.
It's a complicated stew of emotions.
Yeah. And it's, you know, that there might be elements of that. I'm not saying you're wrong. I'm just saying that, like, I don't think you can be like, look at her eyebrow twitch, QED. She's going to be the Mad Queen in the North.
Right.
And then Littlefinger, I thought, looked like a junkie looking for his fix.
Uh-huh.
Like, he's, you know, he's y'all got any more of that betrayal on you? You know, got any more of them chaos? I don't know. He looks small this season.
Yeah.
Like I think he's at the end of his rope, and I think Brienne's going to throw him off a tower next episode.
Could be, certainly could be, or Sansa might do it herself.
Yeah.
My question, I guess, about this whole scene with
that would be
John
funny if fucking Sansa choke slams him too.
Right. Yeah. Don't you think about touching like, me? Or
yeah.
I'll kill
right.
you myself.
That's right. I used to wrestle my brothers and direwolves. I'm twice the man you would be, Littlefinger.
So we've been talking a little bit about, you know, whether Tyrion, whether Littlefinger knows about Jon's heritage, right?
Mm-hmm.
About the secret Targaryen roots of Jon.
Yeah, we're talking a spoiler podcast where like, oh, they're down in the crypts. Littlefinger's going to get crypty down there.
Right. None of that happened. And this would be the time to tell Jon if he was ever going to tell Jon.
Do you think Littlefinger wanted to and he just took a couple bad missteps and ended up getting...
That's what I wonder.
Choked up.
Yeah.
He choked.
Like this was all like a preamble to what he really wanted to say, but he got choked out before he could.
Like I said, I still think it's a good chance that Littlefinger knows all this, but also it could be that Littlefinger's going to play this now that he sees everyone's rightfully skeptical of the Targaryens. He's going to use this to paint Jon in this negative light. But I just feel like the North, like they might think that Jon's doing something stupid, but they're never going to trust Littlefinger. And also Sansa, I don't think we talked about this enough, but Sansa's got all the goods on Littlefinger.
What do you mean? Like,
I mean,
to what end?
She knows he killed the rightful ruler of the Vale.
Uh-huh.
And now she lied about that. But like, if she came to say, like, you know, he said he was going to kill me if I didn't back his story, and I was so afraid. And like, then he traded me. Like, Northman or Vale person is going to be like, yeah, but you lied to us. We're going to believe Littlefinger. No, Littlefinger is going to be instantly seized and fed the wolves.
Right.
Like, he has got – the only reason he's still breathing is because Sansa hasn't decided to turn state's evidence against him.
I mean, the reason he's breathing is his stranglehold over Robin, right?
But like, Robin is so far away, and, like, which is better? Like, if Sansa drops that bomb, does his relationship with Littlefinger – that I think Jon Royce is like, well, it's a good thing Sweet Robin's not here now because then I might not be able to do this. But he – you know, I'm just going to have to tell him a real – I'm going to have Sansa explain because, you know, he's got a sweet spot for Sansa too.
Yeah.
That's the other thing is like if Sweet Robin had to decide who to back, do you think it would be Sansa, who he's got a little kind of pervy cousin crush on, or Littlefinger, who's a cool dude and all –
mm-hmm.
But he's not a beautiful stat, you know, super tall, elegant lady of the North.
Yeah, probably give us Sansa.
I would too.
But I don't know. That would take some time to shake out, and I don't know if they have time.
Yeah.
That's the question.
I would take Sansa too, and I'm not some horny pubescent kid with mom breast issues. So I think he takes her three times and six on Sunday or whatever the expression is.
That's it. You got it.
Three times and six on Sunday.
So we go over to what I think is either the best or second best scene of the episode, depending on what you like. Arya and Nymeria are momentarily reunited in the woods.
It's certainly the emotional core of the episode.
Yeah. No, it's fantastic. Nymeria chooses not to go with her to Winterfell, even though Arya is begging her to, essentially.
Uh-huh.
And for good reason. I really love the last line of this. Honestly, I think Maisie Williams does a fantastic job in this scene. Crushes it. There's nothing to say except for that's not you. And it brings us back to season one when she's sitting with Ned. And I think we talked about this in the Instant Cast. And he's talking about the frilly dresses and marrying lords. And she says, that's not me.
Right.
She's always been a lone wolf. She's always run with a different pack. She sees Nymeria doing the same thing here and not coming with her. And she understands it. And she even admires it.
I mean, you can see her go through the emotions. She's just like when Nymeria first leaves, she's like gutted,
she's
heartbroken,
hurt, confused.
But then, yeah, she realizes that she's being true to herself. So,
and this close up is just amazing.
Let's talk about the for and against evidence for the various interpretations, because there's essentially two interpretations. One, the one that you ultimately convinced me of, is that this is going to reaffirm Arya's decision to go north and reunite with her family.
Mm-hmm.
What are the pros and cons of that line that you want to take?
I mean, the obvious thing here is that Nymeria is traveling with a pack, right?
She's created her own pack,
but it is the pack who's loyal to her.
Uh-huh.
And that could be seen as the Starks, who are the wolves,
mm-hmm.
And Arya returning home to be with the pack.
Mm-hmm.
I think that's the most convincing argument from that side.
Right. The other one is that she's going to proceed south on her mission to kill Cersei.
Yeah.
And I think there's also at least as much evidence for that, too, because she could see that, like, I am like Nymeria. Like, you know, there is this kind of bond between the Stark children and their wolves. And, you know, Nymeria got abandoned and got tossed out of her home and from her family for all the same people that Arya was. Mm-hmm. And Nymeria is not ready to go home and be comfortable and embrace but love. She's still out fighting the fight. She's still a wild animal that will not be tamed. I guess, like, I feel like those are about equal weight as far as evidence goes, and then I apply my personal bias if I want to see Arya be happy. And also, I also think it makes logical sense that she would go and at least meet up with her brother, who is now king in the north, so that she can be more strategic about what she's doing. And then, you know, like, because wouldn't he need, you know, having a faceless man is a huge advantage in a war.
Yeah. Absolutely.
Like, one, it works pro bono. Are you kidding me? Jesus. Uh-huh. So I don't know. I thought I go with the fact that her going north because you with the pack that really swayed me, and that's what I prefer to see. But I think that it's clearly up in the air about what you got from that scene.
Yeah, I'm with you. My personal bias in this scene is there's only one castle with Littlefinger's face in it.
Right.
And I want to see Arya get that. So
yeah.
She's got to go north, in my opinion.
Yeah.
But we'll see. We go over to the final scene here, where the Sand Snakes are rousing each other. It's
having their
pretty
Mama
bad.
Mia slumber party.
Yeah.
It's so gross.
Really just hated this part of the scene.
Yeah. Like, I like that they died how they lived. Annoying as fuck.
Right. True to themselves, yeah.
With their little daggers and their spinny staffs and their fucking whips on a ship. And
yep. I thought the portion of the scene where Ilaria and Yara are flirting in front of Theon was pretty good.
He's very
uncomfortable with the whole thing.
But they did this. Like, I get it. That this is the guy who shoved his hands down his sister's pants and felt her up.
Uh-huh.
So he, in his days, took sexual liberties with her and was pretty gross. But at what point is enough with this guy? Like, this is the, I think, third time that she's sexually teased him like this. And this was, like, also the element of, like, an open invitation for making yourself. I don't know. I felt like it was super gross and dumb and made me like both all characters involved less.
Huh. Okay. They're about to start banging below decks when Euron's fleet attacks. He boards the main ship. He kills two of the Sand Snakes. He takes the other and Ilaria and Yara captive and challenges Theon, who chickens out and jumps overboard to save himself.
Right.
Great scene. This is maybe the best scene in the whole episode. The choreography, the effects, everything is just top notch.
Right. Plus, seeing a literal pirate king in action.
Yeah.
Yeah, that's always Euron's been like the proverbial pirate king, but he's actually a pirate king.
He is. He's more than just, you know, talk.
He also takes an enormous amount of punishment with no ill effects. Like, I think that I saw him get hamstrung five times, and as far as I know, a person possesses no more than two hamstrings, Jim.
Yeah, that's true.
There's one in the back of both your hams. And once that string's cut, you're done. I mean, wasn't that the argument for, like, Lancel last year? Like, a little boy goes and dirks him in the back of his leg, and, like, he's crippled. Like, how many of the snakes got him? And you remember also that their blades are supposedly poisoned?
So I don't know if they didn't get through the armor or what. Like, very dark, and
that's true.
And the room that I'm in watching this during, like, at 7 p.m. is a little too light to really see much of anything.
Yeah.
So,
but they're showing them cutting the back, and he's making like and they're doing close ups. Like, I don't know.
Yeah, I felt that too. I was like, I thought he got stabbed a couple of times. But
yeah. Now, it's something in the books that they mentioned that a lot of iron, like, very few people wear full armor on ships because if you fall overboard, it's a death sentence. But Ironborn are one of the few that do because they don't fear drowning.
Right.
It's like it's like that's like going to heaven for them. So it's like it could be a point that he's just wearing hellacious armor. I don't think they established that very well in. But I don't know. I mean, certainly he's probably more armored than Lancel was wearing his stupid robes.
Yeah, for sure.
You
don't know what he's got under those robes.
Right.
Could be wearing full plate mail.
Could be.
I just can't help but laugh out loud every time What's-Her-Face busts out the whip. I'm like, this is the worst possible weapon, and it gets her killed, as it should. You sling a whip at somebody who's got a sword, or an axe, a fucking great axe, and they're going to chop you in half with it.
Unless your name is Indiana Jones and the movie would lit, like if this was the Sand Snake Song of Ice and Fire, you can get away with swinging a whip like that.
Yeah.
The plot, you got plot armor that's going to beat Euron, whatever magic armor he's wearing. If not, and, you know, I don't know. Like, I don't have a problem because, like, I always thought the Sand Snakes as implemented in the series was annoying and very poorly done. So it is a little bummer because as awesome as this scene was, I couldn't help but think about how much awesomer it would have been had we not had an actual relationship with the Sand Snakes where we cared about them. We saw that they were badasses by their own right, and also that Euron, you know, that he had some chops. This would have been a real, like, you know, a battle worth looking forward to. Instead, it's just a surprise, and, like, it wiped the Sand Snakes off the board, I think. I mean, certainly Obara and Whip Girl are done for.
Yeah, they're both on the front of the boat.
Tyene, is that the one that's the Tyene, mama's girl? Yeah.
It might be. I don't remember their names, honestly. But it looks like her and Ilaria and Yara are all taken captive.
Yeah.
By the end of this. And, I mean, the fleet is gone. Mm-hmm. Euron just entirely fucked the whole fleet.
I don't know that there's evidence this is the whole fleet. Because obviously Tyrion needed two fleets to take one half, you know, take the Unsullied up to Casterly.
Yeah, the Dorne, the fleet that was going to take Dornish up is done. It's gone.
Yeah, that, like, the Dorne are now going to have to traverse over land to get to King's Landing, which, you know,
which
Dorne is known for being mountainous
longer.
And deserty. It's not the easiest thing in the world to do.
Right.
So
the siege, as far as I can tell, is going to be either a half-assed one or it's going to be totally off.
I think, you know, just I feel like it's just not going to work. I feel like that they're not going to be able to contain the Lannister army and, you know, and then with the Tarleys probably joining them. I don't know for a fact, but it seems like that's what they want us to believe.
Yeah.
I don't think that the Dorne won't be there and the Tarleys will be divided, so.
And it makes me wonder, like, how, I guess, devious Randall is willing to be. Is he willing to stab them totally in the back and just,
I don't think so,
pretend like he's going to join the Tyrells in the fight and then turn on them during the middle of the battle?
I don't think he's got that in him.
I agree.
I would feel like, as much shit as he talked about not being a schemer and a backstabber, that he it's only an appeal to his appeal as a countryman and standing against these foreign savages and invaders that kind of won the tide in Jaime's favor. So, like, I would be pretty disappointed to see them abandon that the next episode.
Yeah, I half expect him to send a raven declaring, to the Tyrells,
like, I'm officially declaring
for Cersei,
here's my reasons, and any true Tyrell bannerman would see that this Lady Olenna has gone crazy with grief. But, I mean, it's a tricky situation because these Lannisters, like, they're the reason you don't have a lord. Mm-hmm. And heirs and people to fight for, which I know seems silly to our mob, but, like, that meant a lot back then. So,
for sure,
it's a very powerful political alliance, and people are very attached to their politics. You know, we see that today.
I do like, the explanation of the gift here. Obviously, the gift is Ilaria Sand, right? Mm-hmm. That's the one thing that Cersei really, really wants. Mm-hmm. Is revenge for killing Myrcella.
And this is the one who did it. These were the lips that did the deed.
Absolutely. So when I realized, okay, this is the gift and Cersei's going to do some nasty things to Ilaria, it made me wonder what the hell happened to that Septa, who's still getting tortured by the mountain on his off hours? Like,
probably, yeah.
She's got to be either that or dead.
Yeah. I don't know. Maybe we'll get
that's probably Ilaria's fate.
I would say that we might be get a horrifying glimpse of the Septa whenever we get to just find out where Ilaria's going.
Yeah,
she's going down to the Black Cells too. We'll probably why miss a chance to show the horror that's in store. What do we make of Theon? Like, I felt there's a lot of frustration at him being Kraven, which I don't think it's fair from the understanding of how the human mind works as far as trauma goes. Like, you know, when he's seeing all these people dismembered on the boat, like, it could be that he just had a purely biochemical reaction and he's like, I'm out.
Yeah.
Also, Theon had no chance against Euron.
I wouldn't think so. I mean, he's a competent swordsman, but Euron's a beast.
Yeah, there's just no effing way. He's just going to go and die.
Yeah.
So, like, is it better to be the lone survivor that can maybe dog paddle back to Dragonstone and tell Dany the disaster that happened? Because that's the thing, is like, how long is it going to take for Dany to know that, you know, will she know instantly? Like, how far out of Dragonstone did this happen? There's a lot of compelling arguments about the fact that Euron was heading to Dragonstone just to attack their fleet and try to do something, and that he kind of got lucky that half the fleet was actually at sea,
right?
With probably a skeleton garrison too, because they're wanting to leave a lot of room in their ships for men and horses and supplies to be loaded on.
Yeah,
so he wouldn't load a bunch of like soldiers and stuff on the way down there. So he just kind of got. He kind of got lucky. He was in the right place in the right time. He was heading to Dragonstone. They're from Dragonstone, so it kind of makes sense that they would be in contact.
Yeah,
that seemed like it made sense to me. I'm no longer like calling bullshit about him just happening to see them in the dead of night.
I think my favorite theory about Theon's fate is that Gendry's going to row up and toss him in the boat.
Yep.
Lift him out of the water with one arm.
Yep.
Set him down like a tiny child.
Waters like these, a man's got to know how to row, Theon.
Yeah. Here's the thing about Theon, though.
The last true-born son of Robert Baratheon, rowing in to save the day.
So from Theon's perspective, I totally get it. Like, I don't think he had a chance against Euron. I think the things that he's experienced and been through caused him to, understandably be cowardly in this situation, be afraid. But as a viewer, you really want to root for Theon. You want to root for Theon. You want to see him succeed and overcome what he's been through and take out the big bad and protect his sister. And it's heartbreaking to see him make the opposite choice.
Yeah. And you
to not be able to go through.
And that's the things like how much of it is the fact that he was trauma and he just broke in this moment, and how much of it was, he actually had a strategic idea that my death will mean nothing, so if I can live to fight another day, maybe inform Dany what's going on, like, that's the better call here.
I mean, it's doubly tragic, though, because Yara came to save him when he was, under Ramsay's influence.
I was a little disappointed in Yara throughout, like, not only did you just, sex-tease your brother for whatever reason, but also how disappointed she seemed like in this decision. Mm-hmm. I mean, did she really think that he was going to save her? Was she hoping that he would die in the attempt?
I think she hoped that he would show the same courtesy that she did.
Yeah. Well, that's the thing, is like, he was too afraid to even save himself.
Yeah.
So I don't know.
No, I mean, it's meant to be a moment where you're disappointed in Theon.
Yeah, you are. Yeah. And the thing is, there's been so many of those moments. It's like, what are they trying to do with this character?
Yeah.
Like, I've really thought, like, it's like, wow, this is a whole different arc than I thought. It's similar to like when we saw, Jaime, it felt like that they were developing this friction between Jaime and Cersei, and then they just completely reset that back.
Yeah.
And I feel like this is the same thing with Theon. Like, they were moving his character in a certain position, and then they set him back. Same thing with Sansa. They're moving Sansa to this position where she was going to learn how to wield power and study under Littlefinger. Nope, she's being traded to Ramsay Bolton so she can be, raped and savaged. It's weird. Like, I know I criticize that all the time on The Walking Dead, how people just kind of like go tack back and forth rather than setting a consistent course. And it seems like Theon's doing a little bit of negative tacking here. But I don't know what I'm supposed to. I mean, he's such a, like, even if he's important to the plot, he's not going to be the top 10 most important person.
Right.
So, like, in the grand scheme, do I really give a shit about Theon? Answer, no, I don't.
Okay.
Like, I just don't think about him.
That's the episode.
We're about 10 weeks out from House of the Dragon Season 2, and it's time to prepare for war.
Which in our case means, watching a lot of Hot D and reading a lot of Fire and Blood.
Each week between now and June 16th, Maester Anthony and his co-host Steve are hosting a watch of each episode of Hot D Season 1. And then me and Jim are going to host a discussion of the differences between the events on that episode and how they're recounted in George R.R. Martin's historical tome, Fire and Blood.
That's right, I've resorted to reading dragon books. God help us all. We'll see if my fresh eyes add any new insights or predictions into Season 2.
Arm yourselves with all the lore you can for the battles ahead. House of the Dragon returns June 16th, but we've got you covered until then.
Check out all of our upcoming Hot D coverage on the Hot D feed or on Bald Move Pulp, available wherever you listen to podcasts.
Hey, it's time for another season of Why is Mr. Feeny a Car? The premise is simple. A Gen Xer and a millennial watch old 80s action TV to see what still works and what doesn't. In previous seasons, we've done podcasts for Knight Rider, Airwolf, MacGyver, A-Team, and more. However, this year we're doing a very special season of Feeny. We're going back and reviewing the very special episodes of 80s and 90s sitcoms. Come cringe along with us as Hollywood tries to warn our families of the dangers of underage smoking, drug abuse, alcoholism, eating disorders, and much more. We start out with the episode of Boy Meets World where a high school kid gets sucked into a cult. Worlds collide as the Mr. Feeny finally makes an appearance on Why is Mr. Feeny a Car? Join me and my buddy Jay each week for episodes full of nostalgia and secondhand embarrassment. And don't worry, the very special isn't your speed. We've also got some all-time classic Knight Rider episodes to close the season with. Find Why is Mr. Feeny a Car? Each Wednesday on Bald Move Pulp, starting April 3rd.
We try to make it super easy to support making podcasts at Bald Move. Just join the club.
But some people aren't the joining type, or maybe they're already in the club but want to add a little bit of gratuity for an especially great season of coverage, or for a podcast that really spoke to them, or gave them that bit of support in a tough time.
For these, and for whatever other reason you might have, our tip jar is always open. Head over to support.baldmove.com and click the donate option to say, hey, keep doing what you're doing. We appreciate it.
Once again, check out support.baldmove.com for all the great ways to help me and Jim keep making the podcast you love. Before we get to feedback, everybody go, if you're interested at all, go check out our club sale at club.baldmove.com. You can get 25% off a membership if you use the code GOT2017. And this offer expires July 31st, so this is like the last of our full podcasts that you'll hear a reminder. If you wait for next week's Tuesday podcast, it'll be too late. So it'll be August 1st. So we have another reminder on the spoiler, another reminder on Instant Take. But the club sales, they are not long for the world. Go to club.baldmove.com and use the promo code GOT2017 to get that 25% off a membership. Lots of great features, like I said, in the housekeeping. We got Atomic Blonde movie review. We got Empire Business, where we're taking people behind the scenes of like the nitty-gritty of running a podcast startup. Lots of other special features. You can get previews of all that at club.baldmove.com. So check it out.
This week's sponsor is Away. It's a travel company that makes luggage. That they actually sent us one of these bags. They have a couple of, they actually have four different sizes, but a couple of carry-on sizes, which is nice for me because I never like to check a bag. They sent one to me right before Con of Thrones, so I got a chance to play with this thing, and I thought it was actually pretty cool.
Did you tow it behind your car? Down to Nashville?
No, so I guess I didn't do like an official test of it.
I mean, you either get gorillas, and I don't think we have gorillas, or you tow it behind your car. That's the way you test luggage. It's canonical.
I put it in the trunk, so it was at the back of the car. Is that all right?
All right, fine. I've seen your trunk.
It's messy. But I really like this suitcase. I actually, when it came in, I was a little skeptical because it felt too lightweight to me to be like super sturdy. I have seen, everybody can like kind of remember seeing in the turnstiles. What do they call the airports?
Yeah, turnstiles.
Yeah, those things with have luggage going around them. Mm-hmm. Those conveyor belts. You can see those really hard cases that have like cracks down them and they're like chipped and they just look nasty after a while. These are actually a lot, have a lot more give to them in the plastic. They're a hard shell carry-on. And I feel like they would probably hold up a lot better. And that is the claim, that instead of, you know, having this very rigid surface.
If only you drug it behind the car, you'd know for sure.
I would. I jumped up and down on it. It felt pretty good. They claim they're unbreakable. So, and they give you a 100-day free trial on these things. So if you don't like it for any reason, you can return it. So, you know, if you want to get one and test the claim that they're unbreakable, I say go for it.
I like that feature you told me about, the built-in battery charger.
Yeah, this is the coolest thing. And the feature that I feel like every bag needs and so many are lacking is they have a built-in USB charger for your phone. And it holds, I can't remember if it was 4 or 10 times the amount of juice needed to charge an iPhone fully. So really, like, this bag will charge your phone over the course of your entire trip if you're gone between like 4 and 10 days. It's pretty amazing. It actually has 2 different USB ports that you can plug your phone into. You can charge a couple of phones at a time. I definitely tested out that feature, and it works exactly as advertised. Charges your phone. It was super sweet. Like, I've never seen that on a bag before. I was like kind of giddy when that came in.
Very cool. Can you lash 4 of them together like Tom Hanks did in Joe vs. Volcano and sail to a desert island?
Yeah, why not?
Okay.
Why not? They do use...
The lightweight probably helps with the flotation.
It does, yeah. The reason they're able to do such a good price on these is because they, you know, like every internet company who's selling directly to the consumer, they don't have to go through these distributors. They can cut out the middleman and you get the savings there. And they use very high quality materials. There are actually 9 colors and 4 sizes to choose from. The 2 carry-ons I mentioned, then the medium or the large for extended stays. They're all made that, you know, the material is this German polycarbonate. We always talk about the German engineering with most of our sponsors. That seems to be where the engineering and manufacturing goes when you want good quality stuff. But it felt very sturdy to me. There's, you know, kind of all the interior features you also expect from bags, you know, like the compression plates, or compression system. That's not really a plate. It's like a mesh that goes over your clothes and can compress them down. You fit quite a bit of stuff in there. I packed for my whole Con of Thrones, which was like a 4 or 5 day trip. No problem with all like costumes and all sorts of crazy stuff in there. Fit it all in there. They have, it's one of those bags where you can kind of have it upright on the wheels, like on all 4 wheels. They've got the 360 spinning wheels, which provides a really smooth ride and lets you, like, gives you a lot of options as to how you roll it through the airport. And the best thing I think is that they're all, like, these carry-on bags are all sized appropriately to fit in all the major airlines, you know, strict requirements. So they're not going to say, no, that bag's too big. You got to check it. Charge you $40 for it.
Gate checking.
Yeah, it's ridiculous. Ridiculous?
It's ridiculous.
Yeah, don't be ridiculous when you get on an airplane. And also, they have a combination lock built into
the bag.
That's
Randall Tarley's third son.
Ridiculous. Yep, and they call him that because he doesn't use the away bags.
That's right. It's just ridiculous to think about it.
But apparently, I didn't know this, but the TSA has like an approved combination lock that you can do, and
oh,
it's
yeah.
on this bag.
They gotta be able to search your stuff at a moment's unconstitutional
I guess so.
Notice.
Yeah, but that's built into the bag as well to, you know, keep your stuff secure. I actually really liked it. As I said, there's a 100-day free trial, so you can try it out and give it a thorough testing. Drag it behind your car, have your pet gorilla stomp on it.
Sure.
And if you don't like it, you can return it for a full refund, no questions asked, and also you get free shipping. On anything. Okay, they're reasonable about this, but they're not over generous. The 48 contiguous states. You're in Hawaii, you're in Alaska, you might have to pay a few bucks for shipping.
Right.
But otherwise, free shipping.
Do they ship the luggage into slightly larger versions of themselves?
You know, they should. They should, but I think the value there might be too good.
Yeah.
So, yeah, like I said, if you would like to get a suitcase and save $20, you can visit awaytravel.com/GOT and use promo code GOT during checkout. Do we have some feedback to do?
We do. I just want to talk about a couple things that I got a lot. I got a lot of feedback for not talking about it, so I want to head some of these off. Number one, the giant that we saw in Brand's vision / actual
the cold
thing happened
of,
in the cold
o-
the
was
you
it?
Know,
no it wasn't,
it wasn't cold
open.
It was cold, but it wasn't open.
Right.
It's not 1-1,
right? Yeah,
yes, he's missing an eye, but it's the opposite eye. 1-1. There's like all kinds of arguments. People are like, oh, did you notice the grass was green? Like, I don't know what the hell color corrected television you guys are looking at, but like, no, none of that grass looked green to me. It looked like your standard permafrost Alaska tundra shit that they were marching through.
how we get shit about not talking about a thing when it's not a thing you should even be talking about with, because like, it's self-evident. Like,
I know.
Guess what? Let me just talk about this right now, because I know it's on everybody's mind.
Uh-huh.
Cersei is not Arya right now. That is not Arya with Cersei's face right now.
But
should we go through the list of characters?
I know.
Arya
it's like,
is not.
It's the wrong eye. The fucking grass. Your eyes are smoking it instead of looking at it. 1-1 died at Winterfell.
Right.
His body has
probably been burned.
Yeah, it's a big plot point to the fact that the Army of the Dead is north of the Wall. So how'd they get around the wall? Also, John is not an idiot. He's been burning bodies since season one. If he doesn't burn a giant body, then he deserves every undead wrong eye shot out 1-1 is coming down his throat. So, no.
Absolutely.
If you're free to believe that the giant is 1-1 or some future 1-1 or some premonition of 1-1, but that is not a stance that's endorsed by Bald Move.
Definitely not.
All right. So I just want to talk about that, because like I got like 10 emails about that, and like I swear to God, this week I got 50 because like, oh, I noticed you guys didn't talk about it. They're like, ah! So anyway, just teasing. I love all you
now
guys.
Now you're going to get emails. Well, why are you guys wasting time talking
right.
about these things that clearly are untrue?
Funny. That's the whole thing. It's a bit of a bit. It's the way I amuse myself when I'm drowning in feedback. All right. Jason S., big picture question. What do the White Walkers want? Like, hypothetically, if there's no wall and no one stood in their way, what would they do? Just take over castles? Keep walking? Is their goal to bring winter to the entire world? If so, then what? The Walkers, as opposed to Whites, are conscious, intelligent, and intentional in their actions, more so than just simple wandering zombies. They seem to have some purpose or goal, something more than just being scary and murdering and reanimating someone. I don't think, or everyone rather, I don't think Gurm has given us answers to these questions, but I'd love to hear your best guesses.
I do. I think they want revenge.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Against who? The Children of the Forest? They've been,
against
they
everyone.
Seem like they've been defeated.
The people who created them.
They were the people that created, yeah.
But I think they view everybody as like the trespassers, you know?
Or if there's if they were coded to destroy the first men.
Mm-hmm.
Like, and they've essentially outlived their purpose, or didn't get the message that the Children of the Forest, like, it could be that they're just trying to do what they're set out to do, which is destroy all humanity.
Yeah.
And that's why this is happening. You know, but it does, I don't know.
How nice the weather in Dorne is.
Yeah.
They just want to experience it.
They've been
it.
Cold for thousands of years. They want to see if they can get to someplace warm.
Yeah.
They don't understand that just by walking there, it's going to make it a frozen hellhole. but on the other hand, have you ever had frozen Arbor Gold?
I haven't.
It's
no.
Oh, so good. So good.
Are you talking about the red or the white?
The white.
Okay.
Are they, cause, yeah, it's like, you know, it's a classic Westerosi treat. They take their ice cube trays.
Uh-huh.
They fill it up with Arbor Gold and red.
Little toothpicks.
Such so nice. So nice. Any other thing? Because the one thing about I like the theory about them being these runaway automatons. They're essentially Terminators, been programmed to kill John Connor, except for mm-hmm. they think everyone that's got two legs is John Connor.
Right.
That doesn't have leaves coming out of their ass is John Connor. Except for every time I see the Night King, he seems a little more... He seems too human to be just something that's just running a routine mindlessly. Like he gloats, for example.
Yeah,
like I don't think a weapon of war like gloats and mm-hmm. intimidates and
they're surprised when their weapons are broken by Valyrian steel.
Yeah,
for instance.
Which is another thing. Like if all these prophecies are true and all this has come to pass, how the hell are they surprised by that?
Yeah. What? Hmm.
There's,
what about the idea that they wouldn't be doing this if not for Bran? They're trying to eliminate. All of the green seers.
Yeah, so I think
Bran is the thing that's actively bringing them south.
The problem with that, I guess, is that it's a chicken and egg problem because Bran was recruited by the Three-Eyed Raven before or after the White Walkers had already started marching.
Right, but weren't they trying to find him?
Why would they? Did they know?
No, not Bran. I mean the Three-Eyed Raven.
Oh, but he's been up there for 100 years.
Yeah, but he's been in that tree, like hiding, right?
But he's still
they didn't
in that
know
tree.
Where he was.
He didn't. Yeah. So again,
still in the tree, he's dead.
But what I'm saying is, why would that be the impetus for them to march then? Why would they decided like, well, you had 100 years, old man, your time's up.
Maybe some new shit came to light.
Maybe, but I'm saying it's like we're not privy. Sure, yeah, and also, yeah. The other thing is, like, I would say that we know far less about the White Walkers in the books than we do in the show. Like,
really?
they've revealed so much more about their intention and origins and possible identities in the show than ever did in the books.
Okay.
So I don't know. I don't have great answers for you, Jason. But I do think that you're right in that there's got to be more to them, because I've always felt like they can't just be mindless, pure evil beings, because that's not very Martin-y.
Mm-hmm.
Michael P., I know there's a bunch of hand-waving, which I don't mind for the most part, but if Euron Greyjoy truly has 1,000 ships and he brought a huge army, the ships we saw are pretty big, would probably take at least 15 to 20 men each just to sail them, at least. That would mean he has 15 to 20,000 men. That seems like a very large number for the Ironborn. What are your thoughts? Oh, it's... Look, I had a lot of people... This is the other feedback I want to stem off. Like, I get it. He didn't say build me 1,000 ships on the last episode. He said it like 4 or 5 episodes hence, so that gives you a couple of weeks or months. But just as a favor for me, before you send me an email, Google how long it took to build a tall ship.
Uh-huh.
Like the little Christopher Columbus types up to, like, you know, the USS Constitution.
Mm-hmm.
Like, just Google how long it took a fairly modern society to crank these things out. And then explain to me how in 6 months to a decade,
mm-hmm,
that Euron built 1,000 new ones. And there's also like, well, she just stole his best ships. He still had some of these shitty ships.
Those look like pretty good ships.
He also said, build me 1,000 ships and I'll give you the world. So, yeah, like, I'm not inclined to give him that wiggle room, because that's not what he said in the show.
Still had 999.
He didn't say, bring me a balance of 1,000 ships between the shitty slow ones we have left and the new badass ramming pyrotechnic jaws of death that we have and that are better than anything that we've ever built before. Like, mm-hmm, none of this makes sense. And the manpower, the fact that the Iron Islands made these things when they have very poor natural resources, none of this makes sense. You, mm-hmm, just have to kind of roll. And I'm not bitching about it. I wouldn't even talk about it if it weren't for my email box clogged full of people trying to say it's not.
Impossible.
Unless he's just making shadow ships out of his pee hole, like he's got the Lord of the Light making ships for him. That's magic too. So yeah, it's super dumb and distracting. Hopefully we can move past it. Nick F., I listened to your cast of the season opener and thought you talked about the Army of the Dead scene in the beginning. Unless I missed you saying it, I think you neglected to focus on Bran the Giant. I thought at the time that they were making clear that Bran had warged into the giant and was watching the army, because they zoomed in on the giant's white eye and then flashed right to Bran's face. Am I misreading or misremembering?
That's possible.
I actually think that's the coolest of the theories, the fact that Bran was intentionally warging into this dead giant as like a spy on the inside to keep track of where the Night's King is.
That there
might be now this like Lord Voldemort, Harry Potter connection where they... You know, they now, like, yes, the Night King knows where Bran is, but Bran knows where the Night King is.
Right.
And that's kind of an interesting shadow boxing scenario.
Mm-hmm.
And I honestly didn't even consider that. It should have been obvious, you know, going right to Bran with the white eye. Because we've never seen him do a weirwood, like, surfing without touching a tree, but we see him warg into things all the time.
Yeah.
Without touching it.
Hodor, for instance.
Yeah.
I
thought it was cool.
The whites do have like milky eyes, right?
Yeah, sure. That's the contra. It's like, well,
but I would say it's totally possible.
It's plausible.
Yeah.
I would imagine that would be firmed up, because if that's an ability that he's using, we'll probably get to see more of it.
Like, yeah, that could be just a teaser.
You know, like John's like, you know, where's the Night King at now? And his eyes roll back in his head. Oh, he stopped for Starbucks.
Right.
And he stopped again because of Starbucks down the road. Well, mm-hmm, we'll see. I don't think it'll be a one-off is what I'm trying to say. Charlotte K. from San Francisco. You may have covered this in a previous discussion, but I haven't heard many people talk about something that seems pretty bald-faced to me. In the season 6 finale, Dany sends Daario away and talks about needing to be available for the possibility of a marriage alliance when she gets to Westeros. Then later on, we learn that Jon is actually the son of Lyanna and Rhaegar, which makes him half Targaryen. Wouldn't it seem to follow that due to the penchant of Targaryens to wed and bed blood relatives, she would marry Jon? Not only would it make strategic sense since he is currently the king of the North, and can bring half the kingdom into the fold, but they also have similar ruling of for the people styles. Practically speaking, he's also one of the only unwed males left in the kingdom that would add any value to her campaign. What, Euron? Euron's not a eligible bachelor in your eyes?
No.
Come on, no. Charlotte. I don't think you're being fair.
Maybe for Cersei.
It would also make logical sense for Jon, since Dany is possession of Dragonstone, a large amount of dragonglass, with three fire-breathing dragons.
Also, he's got no other prospects, let's be honest.
He's going to marry his sister. That's very Targaryen, though.
That's true.
Although I guess Sansa's his cousin now.
Yeah.
All right. So what is the case? Because I know we've talked about this. I want to see if you can articulate. What is the case against Jon and Dany just getting married and...
Look, I don't want to put Dany in a Targaryen box. Like, you know, she can do her own thing. Yeah, she's a Targaryen by blood, but I think she's got her own ideas about the world.
Mm-hmm.
So to say she's got to go marry her brother or a relative.
Jon would be her cousin, too.
I think so, yeah. I feel like
nephew.
That's...
Nephew. It'd be that she'd be his nephew.
Nephew?
Because she's sisters to his dad.
Oh, okay.
She's the daughter of the
Mad
Queen.
Oh, well, that's just creepy. I feel like she can marry whoever she wants, but Jon is a good choice. You know, if you're gonna marry somebody, the King of the North is not a bad strategy.
And it's also, you got the Song of Ice and Fire. He's from the,
right.
the North. He's literally King of the North. She's gonna be Queen in the South. Like, you know, like there's it's thematic as shit.
Yeah.
All right. What's the case against it, though?
I don't know that I have a good one.
It's meta, but I feel like it's just too matchy-matchy.
You think so?
It's what everyone has kind of thought of and dreamed about since, like, early on in the season, like, or series. Like, you know, Dany is this queen, and she's going to come over, and Jon is this brave guy, and they're going
to... How about this? We just learned that, you know, it's a translational error to talk about a prince.
Mm-hmm.
Instead, you'd say prince or princess. What if it's prince and princess?
Right. Dragon
and
has John three heads.
And Ice and Fire, and John and Dany. And,
right.
I don't know. Just saying.
And Bran's the third head just hovering over them like a Force ghost. Like Obi-Wan
creepy.
Kenobi and Anakin looking at over from the fire.
They're going to have to put some kind of spell on the bedroom so he can't see in there.
And also, I just think there's a lot of foreshadowing that Dany might turn out to be crazy.
Yeah, that's true.
Or at least they want us. I mean, that's the thing. Like, there's so many wheels within wheels that sometimes I get like, well, they know I know this, which means they must be doing, but they know I know that they know that. And it's like, it's like fucking Princess Bride, man.
Right.
At some point, you just got to drink whatever wine's in front of you and see what happens. Sean McGee, first an idea. If Germ ever releases Winds of Winter, y'all should do a reverse podcast going over the differences between the books and the show to prepare book readers for the new book. If I want to catch up to the show, I'm given it previously on. Worst case, I watch a few episodes. Having to reread Feast and Dance would be brutal when all I want to do is dive in the Winds. It'll be at least 5 years for most people, and the video medium is far more recent and more vivid. I don't know what I'll do when Winds is released, but I guarantee there will be something.
Mm-hmm.
The only way it wouldn't is if Winds never comes out, which is a distinct possibility.
Oh, but George promised it in 2018.
Yeah, well, George 68.
Two Westeros books.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, yeah, and that's the thing. Oh, God, you're baiting me.
I am, totally.
Yeah, so he did this thing last week where he essentially says, maybe I can get Winds out in 2018, which people are like, motherfucker, in 2015 you said 3 months, in 2016 you said 3 months, and then you said that, but next year definitely. Now you're saying maybe 2018, and also you're writing another book? Like, what? Again, George Martin's not my bitch, but I'm not his either. And I'm starting to think that, like, speaking of communication troubles, like, this guy, the fandom, it's a fucking basket case, man.
Yeah, honestly, you should just say it'll be done when it's done.
Yeah, he should totally do a valve and then stop talking.
Yep.
Get, like, I don't understand, like, he still runs this live journal blog. And it does far more harm than good at this point, because everyone's just sifting through his words. And, like, when he talks about watching a Giants game, people get pissed. Like, I get that you don't want to stop doing the things. And I'm not saying you shouldn't have to write or keep a journal, but maybe get off of Twitter and get off a live journal. I don't know. Obviously, I'm not George Martin. He's far more successful than me. But I did have the number one podcast for Game of Thrones for like a brief part last.
Does that compare to the New York Times bestseller list? I'm going to say no.
Well, I'll tell you what. I'll finish my Game of Thrones podcast. I will get to the end of this and be done with it. Will he get done
not,
with it?
Not next year, you won't.
Well, you know, maybe. Maybe. Sean says, my fear, George Martin is like Fat Axel.
Oh, no. Fat Axel.
Like with Axl Rose, he's paralyzed by his success and endlessly dickering over details to make sure he doesn't fail under the weight of his whole Game of Thrones franchise. In short, I'm afraid wins won't just be late, but it'll be bloated and boring like Chinese democracy.
Yeah, that's possible.
I remember the old joke is like that we'll have Chinese democracy before we have Chinese democracy.
Yep.
And yeah, Chinese democracy's out, and we still don't have Winds of Winter.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know. I gotta say, just so you guys know where I'm coming from, is that I stopped caring sometime last year. Mm. I realized it had been so long since I've read the books and had that, and it'd been, you know, and the fact that there is already this like double and triple talking, and I don't know what's going on with George, but it isn't good, and I just stopped caring about it. If we get it, great. I'll definitely read it. We'll talk about it. I'm just. You know, how long can you stay in that expectation of something?
Yeah. As a show only guy, I've never cared.
There you go. Rory, I figured out what was so strange about the Arya Walder Frey scene in season 7, episode 1. Remember in season 5, episode 10, when we see Arya remove faces from Jack and Hagar in the Why Are You Crying scene? The way in which she removes the faces is really cool. She uses a 5-fingered pinch motion. There's even a little sound to punctuate it, and the face slides off. Elegant. Fantastic. Slick.
Mm-hmm.
Now look at the Season 7, Episode 1 face removal. It's a fingers under the opposite jaw motion, identical to Mission Impossible. There's even a stretchy, plasticky sound. There's no subtlety to it, no magic, no fantasy. It's as though she made the mask from rendered bear fat, molded wolf fur, and congealed blood rather than using what you learned in Houses of Black and White.
So
this is the feedback I get.
So this is interesting, actually. Like, does this lend any credence to the idea that this was a hallucination when she was doing it in the House of Black and White? How easily the faces come off?
I remember there was consternation among Star Trek fans that Dr. Pulaski held the tricorder differently from Gates McFadden.
Because the buttons are in the same place. Why would she hold it differently?
And at some point, you got to realize these are actors. These are directors. They're separated by countries and time zones. And they – there are some people suggesting that, like, there's several people, and this is why I read this email, suggesting that this means something, mm-hmm. the change. Like, either they're dissatisfied because it's too Mission Impossible, or it means. I'm like, you've got people ripping faces off. That's Mission Impossible already. Like, I don't understand why the exact Tom Cruise hand motion has people upset, or whether you can divine that there's some kind of she's not doing it properly, or this. That could all be true. I'd just be super surprised about it.
Mm-hmm.
Like, I just really think this is the what she did on set, and she forgot what she did 4 years ago, or the director wanted her to do something different. Like, I just don't think it's a big deal, guys.
Yeah.
And gals. Josh H., do you think there's a connection between Tyrion, Jon, and Dany, and that they all killed their mothers and on their way into the world? This is interesting, especially if you're wanting to play the three-headed dragon game.
Hmm.
Tyrion... His mother died giving birth to him. John's mother obviously died giving birth to him. And Dany, Stormborn, also in the middle of that giant storm, her mother died just after she named her.
Hmm. I didn't know that.
Now, the contra that theory is that a lot of women died in childbirth. Like, women not dying in childbirth, like, mm-hmm. as a common thing, is something that's very, very recent in our modern history.
Yeah.
Childbirth has always been, it's evolution's... Strating the gap between pushing out as big a brain from a human pelvis as possible and not killing the mother.
Right.
And it rides that line pretty ragged. And when the mother dies, well, her narrow hip genes don't get passed on to the next generation.
Mm-hmm.
So is it shocking that in a cast of hundreds that three of them would die? Now, the other thing is that, yes, all that's true, but also this is a constructed story.
Mm-hmm.
So does it mean anything? I think it's got a better chance to mean something than Arya tugging her face off,
right?
North, south versus east and west.
Yeah, I don't think that's going to play into the story, but
It does play
I'm
into,
not
like,
sure of that.
Like, it seems like that there is this, like, people have said there's power in blood, and when you shed blood, and whether you intend to or not, it does, like, release a power into the world or makes power. So I guess the fact that if you're brought into the world with someone that you love dying as a result, that seems like, especially since we're talking about these are all like you know, high and mighty, once were kings in their own right type of blood. Maybe there's something to that.
Maybe.
Van Ellen P. Everyone seems to be assuming the order of conflict resolution will be, one, resolve the conflicts amongst the human factions, such as Cersei, Dany, Jon, and then, two, face the White Walkers. But what if they decide to do the Babylon 5 route instead? On Babylon 5, there are two major enemies, one of them a faceless foreign, a faceless alien foreign invasion, the Shadows, and the other a human domestic, President Clark and the evil Earth government. I've not seen but a couple episodes of Babylon 5, so I'm just rolling with this as a literary illusion. What Straczynski understood is that the domestic human enemy with a name and a face carries more resonance with viewers than a foreign faceless alien horde. Even though the faceless alien enemy is powerful, it's almost like a force of nature, a hurricane, say, than an identifiable enemy. So he chose the heroes resolve the alien conflict first and then deal with the domestic foe at home on Earth as the big finale. In the Game of Thrones terms, this would mean Jon and Sansa and company face the White Walker menace, maybe with Dany's help, but without Cersei at all involved. She sits on the sidelines. Then the survivors unite against Cersei, which would make sense for another reason as well. The clash of the White Walkers would perhaps weaken the heroes' forces enough to reduce them to something like even terms with Cersei's side. As it stands now, Cersei would have zero chance against the combined might of all her enemies, but maybe not after enemies have gone through the ice zombie meat grinder while she watches from the sidelines. I thought this was pretty astute analysis, and it also upends, I think, the conventional wisdom.
It does,
which certainly. Is you got to unite the realm and then fight the threat in the north.
Yeah, I think I don't dislike it. It's kind of the exact opposite approach I think I would take if I were writing the story. But I think, you know, the idea that the audience can relate more to the battle between the humans is a good place to end that story.
Mm-hmm.
Because then, you know, if you deal with the more relatable thing and then have this looming threat of some supernatural force that you don't know that much about,
yeah,
maybe people lose interest in that final season.
I mean, we've dealt with Cersei's smug ass from the beginning.
Uh-huh.
And I get it that the White Walkers were also a threat, but, like, what have they really done to piss us off? Killed that one mother we liked up in Hardhome.
Yeah. Yeah, brought her back.
Yeah, you know, it's like that's like they. There's nothing like the things that Cersei Lannister and her ilk have inflicted on us emotionally, and the Lannisters as a whole. So I think it makes a lot of good sense.
Yeah.
Stephen J. The Jon choking Littlefinger scene in the crypts reminds me of the scene in season one where Ned choked Littlefinger outside the brothel where he was hiding Kat. I'm not liking the foreshadowing for Jon's future, especially with Ned's statue framed conspicuously in the background. I didn't get this when I first watched, but I got to say, there's a lot to what Steven here is saying. Like father, like son, with your dead father looming in the background. Now, of course, he's not his real father. But do you think that this is... should we be nervous for John? The fact that this is kind of like, you choke little... Everyone that's choked Littlefinger, and this is a true fact, has died shortly thereafter.
Yeah.
The Brandon got summoned by the Mad King and put in some kind of contraption where he had to kill himself to try to save his on fire father. Ned got his head chopped off, and now John's doing it down in the crypt. Are you afraid?
As you know, someone with more knowledge than John has of Dany and where he's about to go, I'm not super afraid, or at least I wouldn't be. If John knew why he was going there, and I think he's got a distorted view of the situation because of Tyrion and that letter and what he said, I think Dany is expecting John to come there to pledge his devotion, and he's not going to want to do that, like, you know, just totally have her leading the show. I think that he's going to want some kind of mutual leadership position, and she's not potentially going to be willing to do that.
Yeah.
And... with Elena there, like, pushing Danny's buttons, saying, be the dragon, I could see a bad fate for John.
I'm not even saying... I guess this foreshadowing, it doesn't even have to take place, like, at the hands of Dany. It could just be that he's going to die.
I mean, it's going to be a while. Well, who knows with the pace of this season, but I assume it's going to be a while before he gets to Danny and then goes off and does something else.
Yeah. No, that's true. I'm not overly afraid, but I just thought, you know, since I guess I am, because I think anyone could die at any time.
Yeah, yeah.
But I kind of agree. I don't know why I've decided that I think John is probably going to survive, is more likely to survive than Danny. Because I guess there's not been any hint that John might be evil. Where even in this episode, after Daenerys and Varys hug it out, she ends it with like, hey, if you have crossed me, I will burn you alive. You do realize that.
Right.
It's like, yeah, you can tell me to my face what you think I'm doing wrong, and I'm going to set you on fire. If I disagree with you in any way. Like,
yeah.
There's not been that for John. Like, John banishes, doesn't execute. I mean, it's not like he doesn't execute, but, you know, does anybody want to sit there and say anything about Janos Slynt or...
Oh, come on. Yeah he's killed people who deserved it.
They all deserve what they got.
Yeah, and, you know, I'm considering fucking the Ollie, other side aloud, right. Essentially. Like, I'm very much convinced that John and Danny actually are both going to probably make it through this series.
Wow.
So I'm just sort of considering aloud the possibility that they won't, but I still believe that they will.
Paul O. asks, do you really think this is the last time we'll see Nymeria? Why ever remind everyone that she's still out there with the pack of wolves if this isn't a plan for her to come to Arya's aid at some point in the future?
Well, it reflects on Arya, right? Like,
yeah.
That's the more important thing that it does here.
It could be Chekhov's lost direwolf, and, you know, you could reveal her so she's available for later on. But I agree. I think it's just a nice character moment for Arya.
And it's going to send Arya down a road.
Right.
You know, Arya has had a realization about herself, and what that does is set her up for her next move.
Mm-hmm.
That's why it's important.
Yeah.
Not that Nymeria is back.
And it's a pretty artful way to do it. Like, yeah. We could have this long, like, Arya just soul-searching herself or talking over the hot pie. But I honestly, you know, they did it. It was way more artful and cool and emotional just to have it be a reaction. And that's the other thing that's kind of a miracle. I still don't know exactly which way they're going with it.
Uh-huh.
But there's evidence for both, and I thought it was really great and it was all done visually. It was a show-not-tell moment, and I'm always going to back those when people do it. A man writes in anonymously, says, I feel like I need to say something about the Grey Worm Missandei scene. I myself am a transgender man. In other words, I spent the first 21 years of my life as a female before physically transitioning to a male. I'm 27 now, have a full beard, a beautiful girlfriend, and a wonderful life. That being said, the obsession with castration and endless cockless jokes on the show always makes me cringe a bit. Worse are the endless jokes and questions about how Grey Worm and Missandei could possibly have some type of romantic or sexual relationship. The question of how will they even fuck is way too similar to the way society responds to trans people. Listen, man, there are many ways to fuck, and it's refreshing to see this show scratch the surface. I'm not here to preach about romance versus sex, nor do I feel that being castrated is the same as being a trans man. I just want to say that the scene between these two characters is absolutely beautiful and speaks volumes about my experience as a trans man navigating the world of love and sex, something I never would have imagined seeing on Game of Thrones. I truly loved and appreciated the scene. I know you guys have mentioned how these characters don't seem to have chemistry in the past, but I hope this episode changed your mind. I also hope that the show watchers can step outside of their own experience for just a few minutes to understand how the boundaries of our bodies can be overcome when we find a partner who loves us as we are. Well said, Aman. I can think of nothing negative to say about that. And yeah, like, I don't think we've been huge fans about the Missandei Grey Worm thing, but I felt like the payoff was pretty good.
Yeah, I'm trying to decide if that has... I don't think it's retroactively gone back and changed how I feel about those scenes between them in earlier seasons, but I do think this scene was extremely well done. And
you got to think, like, to the extent that these characters who are important but B-tier characters would have an arc, this is a good arc for them to have.
Yeah. Yeah, totally.
I just am slightly afraid for Grey Worm because we now have found his weakness. Peter N., I did want to get your guys' opinion on Varys' motives throughout the series. He has revealed that his true intentions have been to conspire with Illyrio in order to return a Targaryen rule to Westeros. This is shown by his conversation Arya overheard Varys and Illyrio having in the Dungeons of King's Landing, where they talk about starting a Lannister-Stark war at the same time Daenerys and Khal Drogo come to claim the Iron Throne. He's also saved Tyrion from beheading, delivered him to Daenerys, and constructed the alliance between the Martells, Tyrells, and Targaryens. The thing that never made sense about Varys' motives were that he ordered the assassination of Daenerys at the command of King Robert. I was so excited when he finally was called out on this in the show, I was very disappointed by his answer. It seems to me that he was saying that he was never loyal to the Targaryens and didn't know Daenerys well enough to try and spare her life back then. Mm-hmm. If this is the case, then why has he been plotting to put a Targaryen back on the throne since the Mad King was killed and Robert took the throne? It seems like his plan has been to put Viserys and later Daenerys on the throne since the beginning, but was perfectly fine to be complicit in her assassination.
I mean, as I understand it, he just wanted to see someone who he thought wouldn't be just the worst on the throne.
Yeah, he's like...
And so he's upsetting the status quo.
He's climbing a ladder of chaos, but for the realm instead of for his own personal
glory. Almost building the ladder of chaos in a lot of ways. But yeah, he's doing it for the people. And whether that's a Targaryen that's on the throne or whether it's a Stark on the throne or whatever, he, I think, wants what's best for the realm.
Do you believe Varys?
I do, yeah.
I do, too.
I mean, that's the only thing that makes sense, I guess.
Are we Ned Stark deciding to trust Littlefinger in season one?
Probably, yeah.
Yeah, I mean, there's a lot, obviously, more detail in the books as far as maybe Varys' motivations and whatnot. And I also think they hinted, there's enough in the show that if you just wanted to understand, like, Varys' thought process here, is King Robert orders the death of Daenerys.
Mm-hmm.
And there's dialogue in the books and maybe even the show where, like, between Littlefinger and Varys, that instead of, like, hiring a faceless man, which Dany's ass would be as good as dead, instead what they did is they promised a lordship to the assassinator. And then there's also evidence in the books, which I don't know if that – then there might be some in, like, when Jorah is forced to confess his role in spying on Dany, that there was hints that Varys actually warned – he simultaneously put out the hit on Dany, but then warned Jorah that the hit had been put out. That he was on alert and was able to snuff out the wine vendor and all that stuff. So
okay. It
could be that this is, again, a calculated move by Varys to try to appeal to the current monarch that he can't defy at risk of his neck and also ensure that his scheming went on unopposed.
I forget his response in this episode when... You know, Dany says, oh, you thought my brother was a great king or whatever.
Mm-hmm.
I forget what he says to that because I think her assessment of her brother is dead on. He'd be a terrible king.
I think his response is, I knew nothing of you
of Dany, right. Like but why would he want to back Viserys instead of Robert?
Didn't you get the idea that, like, that's part of what he was trying to say? Look, if Viserys was a nightmare, I would have ganked him too and kept on trying until I got it right.
Okay.
Like but he couldn't really say that.
And there were no other options? I mean, why is, like, Renly not an option? Why is, like...
It's a good question.
Stannis probably would have been a better king than any of them.
Possibly.
He certainly would have been a better king than Viserys. I don't know why.
That's where I do wonder if we haven't got... Like, I think you're probably right that when he literally says I'm serving the realm, that probably means something.
I think that sentiment is true
because I don't think he could ever hold real power. I don't think Westerosi as configured as Varys could imagine being configured would ever be something he would sit on the Iron Throne and rule.
Yeah, I don't think so.
So I do think it's more of an altruistic and he's got his backstory. It's like, look, you know, you and I both have been, you know, powerless and moneyless and with no lands and titles, and we know what that's like, and I know what the suffering of the common man are, and I'm looking out for those, because someone should. So I believe him, but I also think there might be a little bit more depth to it, so we're not getting the whole story.
So you think there's another wrinkle in Varys' story?
I haven't seen him outside of his robes. There could be all kinds of wrinkles.
Probably are.
Who knows? Ruby from Dallas. I got nauseous when I saw Qyburn's big-ass, dragon-sized crossbow. There's a sick kind of symmetry between Joffrey and Cersei here, both looking adoringly at their new weapons. I'm imagining a situation where Cersei gleefully pulls a trigger, impaling a dragon, and Dany watches helpless to stop it. Are we going to have to watch a dragon get skewered like Roz? If Dany wins the inevitable battle against Cersei, I'm afraid it will come at a cost, and we need all the dragons we can get to defeat the White Walkers.
Oh, one of those dragons is going down.
I got to give it up to you, Ruby, because I didn't even see the symmetry between Joffrey's obsession with his crossbow and cruelly killing things for fun and Cersei's.
Yeah.
But that's
that's pretty interesting. You know, I never considered Cersei a monster on the scale of Joffrey until the last season or two.
Mm-hmm.
Like, she's...
Until the wildfire
She's up her own ass, and, you know, she's playing the game the way she sees it, mostly ineptly, but I didn't see the same cruel streak.
Yeah.
The same murderous, insane streak in her until... So, like, that's a good catch. Moving on, Tim wants to know of the following plot lines, which will be resolved and which will be ignored. Hodor's fate. Will he come back as a reanimated white? You got an up or down on that, Jim?
Up.
I think he's coming back. I mean, why wouldn't he? He was killed by the Army of the Dead in the middle of the Army of the Dead.
His body was left there. So,
and it's also going to be a gut punch to see him marching with one of these days. So, I would be disappointed if we don't see a zombie Hodor someday.
Mm-hmm.
What'd be cool is if Bran wargs into him and like starts whipping ass.
Right.
Two, Arya's wish to kill Illyn Payne in the mountain as well as Cersei. Illyn Payne in the mountain have already been got. Illyn Payne by the real life actress struggle with cancer, and the mountain by, you know, Oberyn.
Yeah. I mean, she'll get.
I actually fought.
She'll get another kill. How about that?
Yeah, she'll get another kill as a Cersei, because there's just... That seems a little too neat. I feel like that there's more thematically interesting ways Cersei could die. But we'll see.
Yeah, I don't know.
Arya's desire to see what's west of Westeros. Now, no, that's not going to happen.
Yeah.
I don't see that happening. For the return of Gendry...
I'm
selling my shares of Gendry stock. I've been trying to move them as quickly as possible. I suggest everyone do so as well. Edmure Tully, after the siege of Riverrun, Frey said they'd ordered him returned to the cells of the twins. We actually talked about this a lot on the spoiler podcast, but who is running Riverrun right now? Who gets the twins? Yep. Edmure Tully could reunite the Riverlands and be a valuable ally to Jon and Arya for that matter. So I feel like that's almost certainly going to be addressed.
Mm-hmm.
And six, Littlefinger's offered to Olenna of a handsome young man. I think that's already come to pass. I felt like Littlefinger offered a handsome young man to Cersei and provided Olivar, which was the male prostitute that provided evidence against
Marjorie and Lancel.
Loras. Yeah. And then he provided Lancel to Olenna to balance that scales.
Yeah.
And turn evidence against Cersei herself. So I feel like I could be wrong, but I don't feel like that's something that's still dangling. I think that already happened right in front of us, and a lot of people missed the significance of it because they were thinking it was going to be something more epic, like Jon, I don't know, strung up with an apple in his mouth.
Yeah.
Andrew M., does this setback break Dany's faith in Tyrion? It seems like it was foreshadowed pretty heavily by Lady Olenna's ignore the clever men speech, and all the women were advocating attacking King's Landing immediately. Yeah, I don't you?
Yeah, no, I mean, he had a plan. It was thwarted.
Yep.
How much can you trust his military tactics now?
Yeah. I mean, that's...
I think he got a bad run of luck.
Yeah.
It was a good plan that he couldn't have seen that outcome, but...
Yeah.
Still, yeah, I think she's right not to necessarily put too much faith in him.
I mean, a lot of military campaign, especially in the olden days, comes down to luck. Mm-hmm. Like, you know, just minor little things. And, you know, some commanders get this reputation for being unbeatable, and did they really deserve it? And some commanders that were, like, super tactically brilliant just got shit on as luck. I mean, look at Stannis.
Yeah.
So I think that, yeah, he's going to pay a price. I don't think that she's going to, like, fucking feed him to a dragon or anything.
No.
But I do wonder if that will cause Dany to overreact in another direction, which will bring some momentary tragedy to them.
I mean, there has to be a clash of dragons at King's Landing. You don't build the ballista and then not use it. So I could definitely see her wanting to be the dragon now and taking her dragons to King's Landing and losing one, maybe.
Yeah,
to sort of rebalance her.
Matthew B., the Dornish army should be entirely unscathed by Euron's assault and still quite formidable. My question is, with the orchestrators of the Dornish coup that killed both princes now either dead or captured, who do the Dornish follow now?
Will they still be motivated primarily by vengeance and stick with Danny? Will they decide they've already lost enough since everyone who wanted revenge has gotten killed and sit this one out? Or they become free agents that would be even wooed by the Lannisters?
It's the dude with the big axe. He's running the show now.
He's dead too, though.
He's dead?
Yeah.
Who killed him?
Fucking Sand Snakes.
God damn it.
Had
the Sand Snakes
big,
are killing
badass,
everybody.
Jeweled axe and didn't get to do nothing but slice cantaloupe with it.
We haven't. There's literally no one in Dorne who we've seen now.
Like, right.
That could be in a leadership position. So
yes.
Dorne, as far as I'm concerned, is entirely out of the equation.
Maybe they'll find these little kids like they did at the North and have them kneel in front of, I don't know, some other Dorne person we don't know.
Right.
That's the thing.
They're done.
It's like when people ask me who gets the dread. I mean, I fucking don't. I mean, I can't pull answers out of my ass. Like,
right.
That didn't happen in books yet. And the show has not shown us any other minor lords that were in Roose's cult, the court that could, you know, it's like it's just question mark. So
yep.
That's a really good question that, yes, even though the Dornish army is there and still intact and formidable because they're the one army that really hasn't been bloodied yet in this war.
Yeah,
it's a headless giant now.
Yeah, as far as I'm concerned, they're not going to be a factor going forward. But they do have a massive army. So
to the extent that the Sand Snakes had the people's love, I do think a person like Tyrion, or I'm trying to think of who would be the emissary to send down there. Like, would they respect Grey Worm because of his military prowess?
Would they respect
Varys? I wouldn't think so. I feel like Tyrion is the one. Hmm. He's the most Dornish of
them.
Yeah, but he likes
just failed big time. Like, you know, the same thing about Dany could be said about the Dornish. Would they trust his prowess?
Yeah. And he's a Lannister, because that's a big deal, too. Maybe Dany goes down herself and personally.
Flies a dragon down there?
Yeah, there you go.
That's the quickest way to get there.
Land a dragon on Sunspear and be like, what's up? Everyone's fire and blood. Follow me.
Yeah.
It's the slowest troop transport in history. She just has her, like, two guys per dragon, three dragons. You can move six. Round trip's 2 hours. I don't like those odds, but
no.
All good questions, Matthew. Naomi, I think it's been a long podcast. I think Stormborn marks the exact moment that Littlefinger's rise up the ladder of chaos has stalled. Back in the day when he was just about getting on the Iron Throne with Catelyn and later Sansa at his side, the plan was fairly simple: cause chaos in the lands by starting a war between the Starks and the Lannisters. It went well for him so far, and he's even picked up some cool prizes like the Vale and maybe still Harrenhal. But the rise of the ladder may have gotten too chaotic even for him. He couldn't have imagined the North being more focused on the White Walkers and an army of the dead to the North versus the Iron Throne in the South. He shockingly seems surprised to hear that Dany has landed at Dragonstone with an army of dragons. He's also powerless against the White Walkers and will hold no sway over Dany with Varys and Tyrion counseling her, and Cersei will probably burn him alive if he tries to go back. Littlefinger confessing to Jon that he loves Sansa was a panicky move, his last scramble at some sort of power, his hope that maybe by being friendly with Jon and reminding him that he basically owes Littlefinger that Jon will give him Sansa. But Jon and Sansa are both onto him now. Littlefinger's rise has ended, and all he has to show for it is a loose grasp on the Vale. Do you think that Littlefinger's going down this season and his fall off the ladder of chaos?
Yeah, I think Littlefinger's done. I think he's going to try one more thing. Like I said, I'm still looking for that pivot. I don't think that was Jon. I think that scene with Jon was not a good enough pivot for Littlefinger. Because, I mean, Littlefinger has always been very smart. And I think, you know, as nice as it is for us to see the people who have been getting duped by him for so long... Mm-hmm. Finally stand up to him and realize that he's pulling the crap he's pulling. I do still want that character to be proven very smart in the end and resourceful, because I think that's who he is. So I think he's going to have one more thing up his sleeve that he's going to try, and it's going to be desperate. He might have to turn to like Cersei or somebody. But I don't think he's done right now. I think he's about to make the move that gets him killed.
I agree. I don't think he makes it out this season. Let me put it this way. Who do you think is smarter, Varys or Littlefinger?
Varys.
I agree, except for Littlefinger's always had the better hands to play. He was the master of coin. He could do things, funny things with money. He could bribe people. I think Varys now has the much better hand, and he's smart. I agree with you. I think he's smarter, so I think that he... I mean, the only thing Peter's really got is the Knights of the Vale.
Mm-hmm.
And if John and Danny make some kind of peace accord, that's going to be less than nothing.
Yeah.
And again, he's also like Sansa has ultimate leverage over him. So yeah, I don't think he makes it out of this season alive. Because even if I grant that really cool theory that we're going to invert this whole thing and we're going to deal with the White Walkers before the humans, Littlefinger is not he's not the main course of that meal.
Right.
Cersei Lannister is the main of the people living in Euron Greyjoy, the main courses. He's the B plot to that. So that's mm-hmm. why I think he doesn't make it out this season.
Yeah.
Denora G, how is it that the two episodes have passed and no one at the wall has had the brilliant idea of letting the King of the North know that his long lost brother Bran might have popped back up at the wall? Yeah, with all the jetpacking and speed of light ravening going on, what the hell?
Yeah.
They lose all their ravens. They're really hurting not having a maester. Sam was the last person that could read
at the wall,
and
yeah.
write. Like, I would love to send a message, but I literally can just make an X where my name goes. That's all.
I mean, are we sure that's not true?
That might be. Because they don't have any maesters who do all the ravens.
Here's the thing. Bran can write. Bran can read, certainly. I assume Bran can write at his age with the training from the maester.
His fingers are paralyzed.
No, they're not. Get out of here. They might be frostbitten, but they will thaw.
All he can do is slap a tree now. No. All he can do is he's lost his fine feeling in his fingers.
Mira
can probably read and write.
Mira can probably read and write, yep.
So, yeah.
So even if Ed can't.
It'd be hilarious if like he gets a message from Dolores Ed and it's like in pictograph. It's emoji. It's all emoji. And John's like, what the hell?
It's a picture of a spiky-headed Night's King.
Uh-huh.
It's a picture of a floppy-haired boy and a frowny face.
Yep. Two feet with the international no sign.
Uh-huh.
And then a poop emoji. Okay, moving on. Matt S. from Pennsylvania. I'm confused as to why Sam is allowed to live with a woman and child while studying at the Citadel. Aren't maesters forbidden from marrying?
Sam's not a maester.
Also, he tells Jorah and presumably others he's training to be maester for the Night's Watch, another organization that forbids marriage. He's double not supposed to have women. Seems like someone should prohibit him from his studies for this. That's
absolutely
a solid point.
They should.
Now, I don't know whether he's living in like some kind of like off-campus dorm situation and no one knows that he's got this woman and child with him, but it does seem like that should be an issue. And maybe it will be because there's a lot of reasons he'd be kicked out right now. He's doing forbidden research. That in fact, maybe I should just get to Mr. J's point.
Okay.
It occurred to me as we watched Sam perform an unapproved surgery on Jorah that this is exactly why Qyburn was kicked out of the Citadel. Mm. Qyburn's skills came in handy when he helped out Jaime in season 2. I see what you did there. Do you think that we will see Sam use his newly learned skills to treat others with grayscale, or do you think that is just going to be this mechanism that Double D's use to get Sam and Jorah out of the Citadel and jetpacking off the Dragonstone where they can be reunited with Jon and Danny?
Yeah, I think so.
Because that's the thing. Like, I guess I never considered a fact that maybe Sam just washes out.
Uh-huh.
Like, he's already arguably, we're like, well, okay, found Dragonstone, and he's going, is that going to be sad? But really, that's all he's there to do. He's going to get kicked out. Archmaester's going to be coming in here and seeing him peeling the skin off Jorah, and it's like, get out of here. You got kids. I was going to overlook your wife and kids, but
right.
peeling night skin off, it's just too much.
Yeah.
And he's gone. I don't know. I feel like that's probably going to happen. Aaron, ND, is anyone going to talk about the Iron Bank? Doesn't Cersei owe them a lot of money?
Tons. Yep. And we saw, who was it? Davos, did he go to them and say, hey, give us an army because
indeed
they owe you a lot of money or something? I forget what it was.
I mean, the thing is, at this point, yes, the Iron Bank is like, I guess they could provide Dany with treasure if she needed it. But like, there's so many threats arrayed against Cersei that the Iron Bank, I don't expect them to get in the game if they thought that she would get away with it.
Yeah.
So I don't think it's a plot hole so much as they're just like the 11th thing on the list of 10 things that is the primary threat to Cersei's kingdom. And that is feedback for the week, my sir.
Okay, cool.
Maester. You can send feedback, of course, always to GameOfThrones@baldmove.com. You can also discuss with our fellow fans on the forums, forums.baldmove.com, and keep up with everything we're doing at baldmove.com on Facebook. Facebook.com/baldmove, Twitter and Instagram @baldmove. We will be back. This is not the end of our coverage. No. We're coming back Friday for a spoiler edition where we'll be talking about some nuggets in the books, maybe some stuff that we can glean from the next time ons and combine with what we already know about the trailers and such. No true show production spoilers, but just stuff that we can hint at and theorize about based on the books and other stuff that's been preview materials have been released. So look for that on Friday, and then of course we start it all over again on Sunday night with the instant take. We have as few episodes left as we would be at the mid-season point of any conventional Game of Thrones season.
Mm-hmm.
It's moving fast. We'll see where it speeds off to, where it jetpacks off to next. Until Friday, I'm Aaron.
And I'm Jim.
See you then.